Good morning, morning, ma'am.
Can we be settled so that we can start with our today's work day? And just indicate that this is our third day where we have been doing public hearings on the roads accident benefit scheme. We've heard from several institutions and organizations, and we're highly pleased because at the end of it all, every time when a different organization presents, we become learned. And for the fact that most of the organization are learned colleagues from the law societies of South Africa, of the northern provinces, a lot of law firms who have been coming here as they make a presentation, we become better persons than we were yesterday or than we were a few hours ago. Honorable members, you also welcome the functionaries of both Parliament and the Department of Transport. You are heartily welcomed. Like we indicated yesterday, that we will be starting with the Law Society of the Northern Provinces. That will be done, and we will stick to our agreement as has been, that every presenter will be given 30 minutes strictly, probably 10 minutes to round up, and then honorable members will be given time to tease out what has been presented here. Without much ado, let me get the presenters from the Law Society of the Northern Provinces.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Comrade Chair, and the rest of the honorable members. Thank you very much for the second round of information that we're going to be able to give you in order to help you with your decision-making process. Again, I'm Gert Nel from the Law Society of the Northern Provinces. Today I've got with me Advocate Karel van Jaarsveld, who will be dealing with the issues of the constitutionality of the Road Accident Benefit Scheme Bill. I've got Mr. Kobus Pretorius, who's an actuary, who will be dealing with a few issues regarding the calculations and comparison on whether or not the bill is so pro poor as it purports to be. And then I've got an occupational therapist, Mrs. LZ Jacobs, that will be addressing the rehabilitation issue, which forms the other basis of the benefit scheme bill. So without further ado, I would ask Advocate van Jaarsveld to give us a bit of background on the constitutional issues that he might have encountered in his evaluation of the bill.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Thank you firstly for the opportunity to address you on this issue. I'm one of three speakers, so I'm going to try and be as brief as I can. I was approached earlier in the year to give an opinion with regards to the possible constitutional challenges that might be brought about by the new bill.
Is this better?
Okay, thank you. I'm a practitioner of more than 20 years. I have been appearing in road accident fund matters in most of that time. I've appeared mostly for plaintiffs. I do, however, on the odd occasion also appear for the road accident fund. In fact, I appeared for them last Monday in the Supreme Court of Appeal. I've also had the privilege of appearing in the Constitutional Court in two matters, well, in one matter on two occasions in 2010. Approaching the advice that I was asked to be done, it became apparent that there are three basic reference documents that one needs to look at, the first one obviously being the Constitution, the second one being the judgment in 2010 of the law, in the Law Society of South Africa matter, which dealt with the constitutionality of the new act, which was introduced in 2008, and then finally the report of the Satchel Commission, which was published in 2002 after an investigation that commenced in June 1999. The honourable members will appreciate this is actually a vast question to be asked, so in the time frame I'm going to only deal with the basic points of concern which I identified in doing the advice as stated. It is evident from a reading of the Law Society judgment, and I'll refer to it as the Law Society judgment, that what is required by the bill is a balancing act between the duty which the state accepted in the Law Society matter, that the Road Accident Fund victims are to be compensated and that such a scheme should be fair. Therefore, on that one side, the rights and the fair compensation to be given to the claimants, as against the resources that are available for such a scheme. Now, what strikes one immediately when one looks at the documents available is that the Satchel Commission, by and large, attempted and, in my view, succeeded in making recommendations that strike this balance. When one compares the report to the bill, however, it is evident that many of the recommendations of the Commission has not been taken on board in the new bill. And what is further slightly concerning, well, more than slightly concerning, is that those aspects which will be to the favour of the administrator in the bill have been cherry-picked and kept in the bill, whereas those aspects which are in favour of the victim has not been taken on board. I would like to refer to three basic aspects of the bill. There are many others. I will make available a condensed version of the opinion to the committee as well. I've been asked to do so by Mr. Nell. So I'm just going to focus on three basic issues. The first one is the fact that in the bill there is no more compensation for what is known now in common law as general damages. The Satchel Committee recommended that this be retained in the form of what it termed life enhancement benefit. One may say immediately that the Satchel Commission was ambivalent to a degree to the two general damages, because at the time you were given general damages for whiplash injuries, which was a large waste of resources, and the evidence in the Law Society matter was by taking away non-serious injuries, the saving would be from between 35.8% to 39% of the resources, which was obviously a big saving and which also found favour with the Constitutional Court. However, the Satchel Commission acknowledged that people with serious injuries do require a further form of compensation. The wording in the Commission itself is maybe instructive, and I would like to just read it to the committee, where they ultimately concluded, "It appears that the only real merit in awarding compensation for pain and suffering or loss of amenities and enjoyment of life is to provide victims who sustained catastrophic injuries and or life-changing impairment with finance which provides for lifestyle changes and leisure pursuits in ways which cannot be expected of a road accident benefit scheme. For this reason, any such benefit should be known as life enhancement benefits." By not including this in the bill, in my view, not only Section 12 of the Constitution, which relates to the right to bodily integrity, being brought into play, but also Section 10, which relates to dignity, because we are dealing now with victims who have been injured to the extent that their dignity is also impaired. It is evident from the Law Society judgment already that the court was very serious about compensation to quadriplegics and tetraplegics, but this will also extend to people with severe brain injuries, people who have lost limbs, people who have limbs that have become useless. Our jurisprudence on dignity have acknowledged that this right includes the right for each and every person to choose a life that is meaningful to them. And Judge Laurie Ackerman, a former judge at the Constitutional Court, wrote an entire book on human dignity and expresses the view in the book that in the context of the Constitution, dignity means the human worth or inherent human worth. So retaining life enhancement benefits or general damages, or in whichever way one wants to define it, is going to protect the dignity of these victims as well. And this is a right which has become a cornerstone. It is, in fact, one of the arguments of Judge Ackerman, that the right to dignity is the cornerstone of our constitutional system. There's an added aspect to this. There are severe limitations to what is being paid to the two victims already in the new Act, as well as in the bill. It is understandable to a degree in that it's a social security measure. Resources are limited. The most seriously wounded victims are not going to be fully compensated. It used to be the purpose of the bill to give the widest possible protection to victims. By giving them the further amount as a solace for their general damages, their loss of amenities, We'll also give them an additional amount of money to top up what they've lost otherwise. So my view is that we are now dealing with a further section of the Constitution that's becoming relevant, being Section 10. My second point, I've been told that I've already halfway through my time, so my second point is just a very brief one. It's dealing with Section 27 of the Act. It's a socio-economic right. It's the right to social security and health care. It's already been addressed in the Law Society judgment. The section has a subsection which is similar to the one in Section 26, which deals with housing, and it was held by the Constitutional Court that these schemes are to be viable, not just in a financial sense, but also in a sense of being workable. And as a practitioner that has dealt with the Road Accident Fund for two decades, there is an extraordinary amount of administration that is being introduced by the system. The fund has had many challenges in dealing with the administration that they have to deal with now. And in a situation where they are going to be in charge of every decision that is to be made for the benefit of the victim, I do have a concern as to whether they'll actually be able to manage it. My final point, which is one which I would like to just stand still on for a while, if you will allow me. The bill provides a very, very limited dispute resolution mechanism. It basically allows a judicial, one internal appeal against the decision by the administrator to accept the claim, and thereafter the claimant is to take a review to the High Court. Now that is not much of a remedy, because the judicial review is basically just a decision as to whether the administrator followed correct procedure. In a review, the court cannot make a ruling as to whether the administrator's decision was actually right or wrong. In my research for purposes of the opinion, I came across some articles by an academic from the Northwest Province, Mr. Nyenti. We did an extensive comparison between the dispute resolution mechanisms in social security legislation as opposed to the consumer protection laws, and came to very, very clearly points out that in the consumer protection arena, the dispute resolution mechanisms are very much to the benefit of the consumer. But when it gets to the social security arena, they are very, very limited. The conclusion to be drawn from it is obvious and maybe unfortunate, because if the legislature drafts a bill where a consumer is going to be in a dispute with a private entity, the mechanisms are wide and they are in the favor of the claimant. Once the dispute is against the state, as in the social security branch, unfortunately it's very limited. It would appear as though the obvious negative view of the profession may play a big role in this. Here again, there is a problem in that the Satchel Commission's recommendations have not been followed. The Satchel Commission's recommendations are, with minor exceptions, virtually a mirror of what one sees today in the consumer protection law. It provided a two-tier system of internal remedies and then ultimately the review and an appeal to the High Court on issues of law and of fact, and even allowed the administrator to ask the court for a ruling. The point is that our law in this regard is moving into the direction where internal remedies are encouraged, the courts encourage it, to weed out the non-contentious disputes, so that what ultimately goes to court is a proper dispute, so that the victim is given a fair opportunity to present its case and not be limited to internal appeals, which is going to be heard by the same body that made the original decision. This seems to be, in my view, an extraordinary shortcoming of the bill, and it also seems to be motivated by something other than the victim's interest. It is somewhat unfair to expect of a victim to be left with a single remedy that basically leaves him in the hand of the administrator that made the first decision. I've been informed that my time is up, but that's basically the essence of my submissions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I, if I may ask the honourable members to have regard to Mr. Kubus Pretorius, I referred yesterday to a situation in which the current RAF scenario relating to income of the unemployed is compared to the income scenario of an unemployed under the benefit scheme as to whether or not it is indeed pro poor. And as a point of reference, Mr. Pretorius will be using the case study of Mr. Lebereko that was here yesterday in attendance to give the honourable members a clear insight as to the proposals or prospects of a victim under the benefit scheme in terms of loss of earning benefits.
Chair, honourable members, thank you for this opportunity to present to you. Yes, I'm Kobus Pretorius. I'm an actuary, so no legal background. So I would specifically like to concentrate today on the actual numbers. So as Mr. Nell mentioned, I specifically want to look at the case study of Mr. Lebereko. Now, under the RAF, his loss of earnings, so specifically only loss of earnings, ignoring general damages and other benefits, was estimated around 1.4 million rand. And I calculated the RAB's benefit, the monthly payments that he would receive under RAB's as a once-off amount of around 420,000 rand. So that basically is saying that under RAB's he would have received about 30% of the amount specifically for loss of income compared to which he received under the Road Accident Fund. Now, there's also some uncertainties, so specifically the temporary loss of income benefit. It's not clear for me whether he would actually receive this benefit, and that's for the period from month 3 to 24 after the accident. My understanding is that this depends on the medical opinion and whether he actually will not be able to work. In his case, my understanding is that he returned to work after 2 months, so he would not have qualified for this. And that's based on my interpretation, but there's a bit of uncertainty for me how this is exactly identified and the medical standards that will be applied. The long-term benefit, that's from month 25 and up to retirement of age 60 years, uses 75% of the pre-morbid income, less the post-accident income. So there's also a number of uncertainties for me, so it's unclear whether the income at the time of the actual accident should be adjusted for inflation to say the 2 years inflation till month 25. And then there's also reference in the post-accident income to deemed income. So under the Road Accident Fund, it is quite common for someone who, as a result of the accident, they might lose their job, and as a result it might take after the treatment and recovery, it might take them a few years given the unemployment situation in the country to secure employment again. So for me the Act refers to deemed income, and I think that's also something that needs to be looked at closer to ensure that we don't penalise someone that struggles to find employment but they actually lost their job because of the accident in the first place. And then there's also a reference that passive income needs to be included in specific reference to the post-accident income, which I also think might be unfair, as savings might then be included in the post-accident income, which is not really earnings, but rather a return on savings. So that's something which I think also needs to be looked at a bit closer. Now, looking at this example, one might conclude that, well, the RAB is more affordable, the benefit is significantly less. However, that is not necessarily the case. And I would specifically want to look at the medical expenses, and referring to the True South report that True South Actuaries and Consultants compiled dated 20 January 2017, that the medical cost, including the rehabilitation benefit, will be about 3 times the medical cost currently under the Road Accident Fund. So even though the loss of income portion might seem significantly less and there might be a saving, the actual cost of the overall system might still be much more. There's also a lot of uncertainty surrounding the introduction of no fault, and it's specifically two areas that this may impact. Firstly, of course, the number of claims that will be lodged, And then also the average cost per claim, because currently if there is a partial fault, claims can be reduced, so the what we call the merit apportionment. And then there's also actually pre-accident conditions that can reduce a claim. So if someone had a medical condition that may cause them to suffer a loss of earnings later in their life, and now they have an accident that may, bring it forward, that will be taken into account to reduce the actual claim against the road accident fund, and the RAB bill is unclear for me exactly how that will also be used. So the no fault for me is a huge uncertainty what that will bring, and also the medical expenses. So for me the road accident benefit scheme costing is, as I mentioned, sensitive to the healthcare costs, and specifically also the tariffs that will be used, and also the impact of no fault that is also uncertain. And for me, the report that was prepared by TrueSouth is a good report, but I do think that one needs to be careful to not only look at the possible savings, but also about all the warnings that's included in the report. And I've included just some quotes here, so even on page 7, they, for example, mentioned that it is subject to large number of uncertainties and even unknowns at this time. It's also important to note that the removal of general damages is probably where most of the savings will be generated, and I've calculated it based on the numbers included in this report as around 27.29%. There's also uncertainty around the administration expenses, so they assume that it will remain the same. I'm not so sure about I would have expected a much more thorough benchmark analysis being done, more investigation about the administration expenses, because my understanding of the RABS bill is that it's basically a pseudo-medical scheme that will be introduced specifically for road accident victims, and I worked in the medical scheme environment a number of years ago, and that's quite admin intensive. So I would have expected, given the sensitivity of the cost in relation to the administration and also the healthcare expenses, that there should be maybe a bit more work done to ensure we don't end up in a situation where RABs actually are more expensive. And then also they've included a section on sensitivities, as an actuary, we will usually include sensitivities to also try and demonstrate the level of uncertainty that we expect given the results that we've provided. And they've included for me quite large sensitivities, which is the 30% more accidents. They've included other sensitivities as well. But for me, this indicates that they, as the authors of the report, really wanted to emphasize that there is quite significant uncertainty about the costing and that one should be careful. If the 30% more accident scenario ends up being the reality, the RAS will definitely be more expensive compared to their calculations. So my view is that firstly one needs to consider trends as well. So more trends need to be considered in the report to ensure that we can analyze the changes over time. That I would expect maybe a second independent costing exercise, but maybe by actuaries that have experience in the field as well, using the same data that was available to the TrueSouth team. And then I would expect maybe more detail on the specifically the uncertainties and sensitivities to see, are we really comfortable about this costing, or where do we think is the key areas that we need to investigate and research more. And then the reason, the further thing that I think needs to be analyzed is the medical tariff. It's extremely difficult to cost something if you don't know what it will cost. So for me, the medical tariff needs to be decided on to be able to really say what the medical cost and the rehabilitation cost will be. But there's two problems that I also see with the tariff. So if the tariff is too low, I think it will result in unwillingness of the private sector to participate. However, the higher the tariff, then you also have the affordability question with the RABs being more expensive, specifically in relation to medical costs. It's also quite common for those of us who have medical scheme, we would know that the medical schemes have the in-house medical tariffs, which they would usually refer to as the medical scheme tariff. And many of us that might have claims in the past would know that there's usually co-payments or there's always something extra that needs to be paid out of your pocket. And this is generally the case. Usually the medical schemes have options where they cover up to 2 times their tariff or 3 times their tariff, but then after that it's for your own pocket. So for me this is just a risk that if it's similarly administrated as a medical scheme with a specific tariff, and there's nothing that stops the providers to charge freely, then you might get a scenario where the road accident victim would in any case be liable to pay the excess fees charged, which is my understanding is exactly what we are trying to avoid with the bill. So a few proposals which I want to make about the affordability of the road accident fund. So we'll quickly run through them because my time is basically up. So I think firstly one needs to investigate the current cost drivers in more detail. If it's legal to remove general damages, and the argument is that it should be removed, then that's something that can be done under the Road Accident Fund as well. One doesn't necessarily have to remove it completely. One might say that we need to pay X percentage based on the affordability and that's general damages. If expert or legal fees are seen as excessive, I think one needs to investigate it and consider specific solutions related to that. For example, maybe prescribe hourly fees if possible, and then also to in the cases, it's quite general that there's 2 experts, you know, 2 industrial psychologists, one for the defendant, one for the claimant, 2 actuaries, 2 orthopedic surgeons, etc., that's appointed. I think there should be a situation where only 1 expert must be appointed with the claimant or the defendant then either agreeing to that expert report, and only when there's disagreement they can appoint a second expert. I think the inefficiencies regarding the administration and the legal defense of the Road Accident Fund claims can be looked at. And then I think the structural problems, specifically in relation to private healthcare costs, you know, the competition law, the cost that's managed or not managed by medical schemes, hospital groups, etc., needs to be addressed by the Department of Health. My understanding is that there was last week an article that the Minister of Health made a few recommendations, and that is something that I think is quite welcome. I'm just not sure whether it will be legal, but hopefully that will be fruitful. And then if we can generate savings, then I think one can follow a stepwise approach to introduce no fault only for medical and rehabilitation costs, and then we can build up statistics around no fault as well as to get more clear indication of the actual medical and rehabilitation costs. So this will reduce uncertainty and then put us in a position to maybe 5 years down the line see whether we can enhance the benefit, for example, to maybe pay to introduce a minimum monthly benefit on a no-fault basis. And that's my submission. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The members, honourable members, would be reminded that I referred yesterday to one of the other primary objectives of the benefit scheme bill is to facilitate rehabilitation, and Mrs. LZ Jacobs will give us a background on the accessibility and realities of rehabilitation in the current dispensation and going forward to the Road Accident Benefit Scheme Bill.
Chair, thank you. Thank you for allowing me the time. Chair, honourable members, I'm Alda Jacobs. I'm an occupational therapist. At my practice, we have recently completed our research regarding the rehabilitation centres in South Africa and the relevance thereof on the proposed RAPS bill. And I would like to share that research today with you as well as my views on this. RAPS prioritises rehabilitation and emphasises return to work of the injured beneficiaries. This is stated, may result in decreased benefit payment periods as benefits will cease when the beneficiary returns to work. The intent seems to be to save money by returning the injured person to work. 4 friends were travelling in a taxi. There was a terrible accident. All four of them sustained serious injuries. Let us examine the presumption by using our four friends as case studies. Two of the serious injured friends were unemployed at the time of the accident, and they thus had no job to return to. On the premise that they were to be returned to work in order to support the financial viability of RAPS, in that the monthly payments will cease when the beneficiary is successfully rehabilitated and returned to work, RAPS will then, after successfully rehabilitating them, will have to pay for specific job training at an appropriate training institute to provide these claimants at least with a chance of future employment, and then will have to find them a job. Well, it's quite a challenging exercise considering the high employment rate in South Africa, especially for people with disabilities. The two other friends were employed in high-risk occupations, which means that they can easily be replaced. Both were lucky enough to have received adequate and timely medical treatment, and both qualified for physical rehabilitation and vocational rehabilitation. Let's meet Sam. Sam is from Limpopo. Sam is a builder. He sustained multiple fractures to both lower legs. After his initial treatment, he had to learn to walk again. Since there is no rehabilitation facility in the province, he was sent to Tshwane Rehab in Pretoria. He was unable to undergo the vital follow-up sessions as he did not have the money or the assistance to travel to Pretoria once a week. They also do not have vocational rehabilitation at Tshwane Rehab, and thus he receives no work rehabilitation. His closest clinic to his home is 100 kilometers away. There's no occupational therapist, no physiotherapist at this clinic. There's also no return to work plan in South Africa to monitor the process of returning the injured to work. Sam lost his job. Sam was the only breadwinner. His family is now destitute. Because RAPS is largely based on rehabilitation, it is important to look at the availability of rehabilitation and vocational rehabilitation facilities in South Africa. You'd be surprised to know that countrywide there's only 35 available rehabilitation facilities. Of these, 11 are governmental or state, and the remaining 24 exist in the private sector. I hope you can see that clearly, maybe not that clear, but let me give you a summary about the rehabilitation facilities in South Africa. Only four of our provinces, Gauteng, Western Cape, North West and KwaZulu-Natal, have government or state rehabilitation centres. There are none in the other five provinces. The private sector only covers Gauteng, Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, Free State and Mpumalanga. There are thus neither state nor private rehabilitation facilities in two of our provinces, namely Limpopo and Northern Cape. Also, there's only 18 private facilities countrywide offering vocational rehabilitation. Now, the difference quickly between rehabilitation and vocational rehabilitation, rehabilitation is typically to get the guy to walk again. Vocational rehabilitation or work rehabilitation would be typically to get the guy to work again. So if he needs to walk far distances or stand for long periods or carry heavy things, he would need to undergo vocational rehabilitation. There are five government institutions that offer some kind of vocational rehabilitation, but it's very limited services and it cannot really count for a service. Overall, services seem to be most limited in Limpopo, Northern Cape, Mpumalanga and the Northwest province. Patients of these provinces are mainly treated in Gauteng. The other problem is the location of these facilities. Most are close to cities. So the people in the rural areas have no place to go to, and they are the people that's most disadvantaged by the lack of these services. Our other guy, Sandaku, he's from the Western Cape. He sustained a serious head injury. After recuperation and discharge from hospital, he was placed in a rehabilitation facility and it also offered vocational rehabilitation. He was lucky, he's from the Western Cape, so these facilities were available to him. Although the therapists were closely with his employer to try to reintegrate him back to work, he also lost his job. Why, you might ask? Some darker brain injury left him with serious memory and concentration and other cognitive problems. No amount of rehabilitation could restore him to the man he was. One should be careful not to make a common mistake of assuming that rehabilitation will always restore function. Rehabilitation, in fact, can only facilitate the process of recovery from injury and, in a very few cases, would restore the person to who he was. Most claimants of serious injury will remain with some residual difficulties, and it will continue to impact negatively on their work life and on their home life. Although rehabilitation is necessary for almost all serious injuries, one must understand it is not a miracle maker, and it cannot automatically erase injuries and reinstate full function. I conclude. I fully agree that rehabilitation and vocational rehabilitation is vital for people that was employed at the time of the accident to provide them the opportunity to enhance their function and possibly return them to work. But I must say, it cannot only be offered to people that was employed at the time of the accident. It should be offered to all seriously injured people. And even though that wouldn't save money, it is the right thing to do. It is humane. It's a basic human right that everybody should be offered these services. However, the plan to support the financial viability by means of rehabilitation in order to place beneficiaries at a workplace is clearly not realistic. To summarize, why do I say that? Like I illustrated, there's a vast lack of rehabilitation facilities in South Africa. Then, the ambiguous nature of rehabilitation, it is not always successful. You can't guarantee success. Then, the high unemployment rate, especially regarding the disabled. Also, the lack of procedures to support the return of the injured worker to the workplace. The high percentage unemployed individuals involved in road accidents. And even more compelling is the low percentage, only about 5% of claimants with injuries seriously enough to qualify for rehabilitation. Now, rehabilitation, like I said, is really vital for those who qualify, but I fail to see how it could, especially in the current circumstances, support the financial viability of RAPS. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. You are left with 3 minutes. You want to utilize that? Can I proceed?
Referring to the comment that was made last week by the department in relation to a question that was posted as to the accessibility of a victim to the benefit scheme on the subject of being pro poor. The department states there is no claimants under the RABS will not be able to afford medical reports required to submit a claim. Will this not exclude such claimants from claiming? That was the question that was posted to the department. The department's answer to that was that the cost of the medical reports is included in medical benefit, therefore claimants will not need to fund such reports, as same will be paid by the administrator. Now, if we have regard to the Act clearly stipulates that unless otherwise provided in the Act, now, this was, as reference, the department referred the honourable members to a specific benefit as an explanation, but I think we should just be clear on exactly what this means. It says, unless otherwise provided in the Act, the administrator shall not be liable to contribute to the costs of an injured person, claimant, or beneficiary, including his or her medical and legal costs, to prepare and submit a claim or an appeal or to meet any requirements in terms of this act. And then the department directed the honourable members to a specific section in the act as an explanation as to the fact that the act actually caters for that. But with all due respect, what they failed to explain is that this benefit under the medical benefits heading only kicks in once you've already successfully lodged your claim with the administrator. In other words, this benefit of assisting victims with their costs to obtain their hospital records to show to what extent they were injured or to get their accident reports and mirror documentation, which is almost an impossible task even for attorneys these days because of the administrative issues that we encounter. These are all things that are expected of victims before they can engage the administrator. And once they lodge a claim, the administrator can deny that claim within 180 days. So there will be no financial support. I just want to make that a point of clarity. The Act doesn't allow for the administrator to pre-fund the lodgement of a claim. That is expected of the victim himself, and that's why we submit that the very people that the bill is supposed to protect are being prejudiced by a bill that on face value seems to be very accommodating, but if you look underneath the surface and the implication of the bill, it is clearly not the intention of the what is written here, because if we have regard to Section 43, there are certain requirements that are set for a victim to meet before the administrator will attend to his matter, amongst others, medical reports, mirror documentation, anything related to him being able to prove that he was in an accident. And I just want to make it clear, the fact that the bill might stipulate that it is no fault, doesn't mean that it will mean automatic benefits. The victim still needs to qualify to be able to gain access to those benefits. And our concern is that these victims are cut off immediately because, as Mrs. Jacobs has also referred to, many victims don't even have the money to phone to make an appointment to go to rehabilitation or whatever the case might be. And just as a last point of reference...
Your time has long expired.
Chair, just one little quote from the bill just to prove that point is that the administrator has the authority to suspend any benefit until the beneficiary has complied with the requirements imposed on him or her in terms of this section. And that's just the point. If they can't attend the medical treatments because they don't have financial needs, they won't be able to gain access to the benefit scheme laws.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, there we go. I see Honourable Turco, Honourable... Let me start at the back, Honourable De Freitas, Honourable Sibanda, Honourable Turco, Honourable Bata. Honourable De Freitas.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I've just got some questions of clarity over about what's been in our files. And can I ask that the presentation we got today, could that be emailed to us? We could just have those additional information. Just a few questions, Chair. the one presenter spoke about extraordinary administration. That is, it's quite onerous administratively. What would your proposals be as alternatives, excuse me, to alleviate this administration and red tape? I know it's a very broad question, but just, yeah. What would you like to see happen instead? Then I'd like just to unpack a little bit more about under RAVS, anybody can claim. So I just wanted to confirm, so it would mean that a drunk driver could claim. You could actually benefit if you get drunk and drive. So I just wanted that to be unpacked a little bit more. And then you're saying that in reality, RAVS favours employed people and not unemployed people. And talk a little bit more about that. And also what you're saying is that no matter who claims, whoever you are, for the first 180 days, that's quite a few months. You're not going to be paid out in any way. So if you are seriously injured in whatever way, unless you can personally finance that rehabilitation or whatever happened to you, RAVs, under RAVs, the RAV system, nothing will be paid out in 180 days. That's really just some early clarity that I need right now. Thanks.
I'll respond to the legal issues, and then I'll just direct the question regarding the actuarial aspect of it to Mr. Pretorius. As far as the administration is concerned, we made the point yesterday that there should be proper benchmarking and proof that the department has done everything in order to convince the public and ultimately the members of this portfolio committee that they've done everything reasonably possible to show that under the RAVS dispensation they will be able to muster the administrative burden of having to administrate essentially a medical aid that incentivizes being in an accident, because that's principally what a no-fault system implies. So we just saying that if this is the intention, then at least we must just be convinced that they would, having regard to the poor performance of the Road Accident Fund, which is commonly known. Our concerns are because based upon the fact that at this point in time, in contradiction to what the Statutory Commission said, the current Road Accident Fund and the RAVS administrator will be amalgamated into one system. And our concern is that it's just going to be the current RAF with a different jacket on. We'll just refer the question regarding the employed and unemployed to Mr. Pretorius, and the question regarding drunk drivers and who can claim under the no-fault system to Advocate Van Jaarsveld, if I may.
Is that to the advocate?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. It is certainly correct that a drunk driver will be able to claim under to terms of the Act. It also goes further than that. People injured while committing a crime might also qualify, will qualify for benefits in terms of the Act. As practitioners, we know that the fault system is actually the fairest system amongst the actual victims of accidents, because the fault system creates a spread between the victim that's been more negligent and the victim that's been less negligent, and prevents people who have basically caused the accident themselves from getting any compensation, which on a personal, interpersonal level seems to be much fairer. The second point needs to be made about the fault system. It does create a major challenge for the bill, because it is inherently going to be more expensive than a no-fault system. It creates a scenario that expenses need to be cut elsewhere to justify the fault system, which means that more deserving claimants are going to get less money, and unfortunately also means that less deserving claimants are going to get more money. Thank you.
You, ma'am? Oh, okay. I thought it was yours.
Honourable Member, I'm not 100% sure when you refer to the favouring of the employer versus the not unemployed. Are you referring to a general, in general, or did I have a specific example which I mentioned? General. So I think there's I can say I don't necessarily think that the Road Accident Fund favours the employed, and I say that because currently under the Road Accident Fund, someone who is unemployed, the medical experts and the industrial psychologists will actually...
Sorry, Chair, can I just clarify? Yeah. What I'm saying is this not an unintended consequence that the authors of RABS are doing this? That an unintended consequence, it's the employed that is favoured over the unemployed.
Chair, can I answer? It seems, if I understand it correctly, that RAVs want to save money by putting people back to work, so then the payment of the benefit will cease. So in that regard, they offer rehabilitation and work rehabilitation to these people as a means to get them back to work so that the benefits, the payment of the benefits can cease. That is the whole argument behind that, and that's why I explained that we do not have the facilities, and also that people that was employed at the time of the accident wouldn't necessarily be returned after rehabilitation.
Honourable Member, are you satisfied?
Okay.
You want to respond?
Yes, please, Chair. I think it might be the deemed income which might create a problem. So the post-accident income that's being referred to in the bill is actually the deemed income. So if someone is unable to find employment, but they are deemed to be able to earn an income, they might not be able to claim. Yet they might be penalised because of the unemployment situation in the country, and not necessarily because they are unable to earn. And the accident might have caused the unemployment in the first place.
Thank you very much, Honourable Sibande.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you also the presenters. Nevertheless, Chairperson, there are things which I wanted, maybe if they can clarify us. I mean, yes, I'm subject for correction. Your concern and also your contribution, it was about around sexual commission, the bindings. But my understanding, it was not sexual commission alone. There were numerous commissions since this motor vehicle accident insurance started in 1942. There were a lot of commissions, not sexual only. And you know, my concern is that most of the people who are contributing, even from yesterday, is that even last week, what is our intention about this bill? I want to get from your side, because my understanding from our side, number one, is part of transformation, and then also is to make sure that we need an amicable solution concerning the atrocities which were happening in the past. I'll put an example. You know, in your example which you put for about this case of Sam in Limpopo, I can give you another case myself, the negative side case. An attorney, 46 years, in Limpopo, appeared in Louis Trichardt Magistrate Court a few weeks ago. In Limpopo, yes, Louis Trichardt. I'm sorry maybe for the pronunciation.
Are you all referring to Limpopo because I come from Limpopo?
Okay. Limpopo. Okay. Where's that? Don't try.
Why can't you use Mpumalanga instead of
Mpumalanga? No, this incident. Sorry, Chairperson. This incident, the case which I'm referring to, it happens there. It happens there. Whereby an attorney of 46 years appeared in Louis Trichardt Magistrate Court, and then was arrested by Hawks on Wednesday, 25 April 2018. And the suspect who was based in Thohoyandou was struck off run by the Limpopo High Court in 2010. It means that this guy continuously so was struck out of the road by the Limpopo High Court in 2010 for embezzling money from RAF. So what do we say? Because the intention is to protect, that things mustn't happen like that. But if we say this, we mustn't whatever, it means that it must continue, that the allied people must continue to do what they like with the RAF fund. And then the suspect was managed to pocket 1 million rands. And then also another case, I'll put exactly only two cases. One guy in Pietermaritzburg, a man was accused of stealing from road accident fund about 6 million rand. According to charge sheet, Mohammed Ibrahim submitted false claims to the road accident funds that he had been seriously injured in a car accident in 2022. His co-accused are his wife, son, and also Niresha Noah, who allegedly submitted false claims. So, I'm just citing an example that we mustn't pick and choose. Let us face the reality that what do we need? Whom do we prioritize from your side? Whom do we prioritize? Because to me it seems that we're not in the same path. Because if you talk about unemployment, we do have social services as well. And then some of the issues you raise, we do have health, of which health is dealing with some of the matters in terms of the new proposed, you see, to address some of the issues in terms of health. But this one, whom do we defend? Also, you mustn't forget that there was an allegation that there is a group of doctors and lawyers who had a contract which was signed before I was born. And these people, they don't want to terminate services. They wanted to continue servicing. Concerning what? Whom they've agreed. They don't want to terminate their service. But as people with the lawyer, with the legal background, how do you assist us on that in that regard? Because no matter you can have some good intention, but your good intentions, sometimes they are being nullified. With that issue, with that claim which I was making an example of that two guys, the issue of Peter Maritzburg and the other, that one of the bomb. The fact is one, the victims, they receive nothing. Only they are being used as tokens that bring your ID, bring your particulars, I'll sort it out for you. The intention of the bill is to protect people, because most of the people, they sing the song that they protect the poor of the people, but when we check records, the very same people who claim that they wanted to protect the poor, most of the criminal acts are from them. I don't mean you as a person, but from the legal fraternity. So how do we protect people then? Because when we started Chairperson last week, there was a person who said, then we rather check to court. No, take to court.
You must say things clearly.
You see, so I wanted to correct that, you see, because my little idea, I don't have a legal background, is that we need an amicable solution how to tighten the screw that people mustn't misuse the very same fact. Not to say that we stand as if we are representing the village, while we give a leeway for other people to steal more. I don't repeat this question. Last chairperson, to an extent, if the presentation of yesterday, I even asked a question that maybe is that sometimes we didn't name and shame some of the associates who are associated with some of the lawyers who are coming here to present. Because it might happen that I come here while my friend is deeply involved in these things and was charged to an extent in the court of law. So, what is your take, lastly? Because my understanding is that so far, so good, since there were this arrangement that the advancements of protecting the RAF plus minus 1.3 million was saved before by the hawks, before fraudulent activity took place. And if you check on records, who are the people behind? Most are lawyers with some people. So may you please help us in that regard. What is your take in that regard? How to defend ourselves in that regard as well? Because I can hear you complaining about Section 12 of the Constitution and Section 27 as well as Section 36. Thank you, Chairperson. Over to them.
Thank you very much. I hope you were able to get what the question is.
I have comment.
Sorry, David, may you please protect me. This thing mustn't happen. Yesterday something happened there. That some people who came here to listen to us, when we are interacting with the people who are presenting, always they say, If they want me to direct to them, I can direct to them. I've got the witness here. It's happened yesterday and here. Now it's happening again. They know themselves. I don't want to mention their name.
Let's respect members as and when they are asking questions. You may be holding a view, but forever hold your peace.
Honourable members, Honourable Sibande, if I may, as a councillor of the Law Society of the Northern Provinces, I can put the honourable members' minds at ease in terms of the relationship between the Law Society and the Road Accident Fund. Last year, a memorandum of understanding was signed between the Law Society and the Road Accident Fund in terms of which certain internal arrangements were made in order to curb, if we may call it fraudulent or strange activities. So there's a working relationship between the Law Societies and the Road Accident Fund in order to obviously curb the problem. I just want to reiterate that these are individual occurrences. Having regard, and if we can take a average day in court, there's about 150 RAF matters on the roll for specific reasons. And if you have regard to the voluminous nature of the work that we do, and you look at one or two articles that appear once or twice a year regarding some attorney that has done something untoward, I think, with all due respect, it's to generalize the whole legal fraternity because one or two individuals are putting us to shame, I think is a bit unfortunate, because many attorneys do sterling work for their clients. Mr. Lebereko's matter yesterday is a clear example of that, and there's daily occurrences in which victims are literally put on their feet again and given the opportunity to advance their lives and to attain a better life quality because of the influence that the attorneys has played. So I'm not disregarding the fact that there are some of our members that should be looked at more carefully, but I can assure the members that there are measures in place. The fund has an internal investigative unit. I might just add that for some reason or another, the internal investigation unit of the Hawks was disbanded under the previous CEO's administration for reasons still unbeknown to us. So we're not exactly sure if it is the purpose of the fund to curb these type of occurrences. The disbanding of that specific unit that you were referring to raises quite a few questions. On a personal note, Honourable Simbandi, I made reference yesterday to the direct claim route that the fund is taking on matters as we sit here. And I've explained to the members exactly what the problems were in terms of their bill, and that the fund is acting outside of the four corners of the bill, which is fraudulent. It's a fraudulent occurrence that happens on a daily basis inside the fund in 100 administrative offices all over the country. And with all due respect, it just doesn't seem as if the honourable members are realising what the extent of the nature of these actions are. If you're looking at individual attorneys that are doing strange things, I think we should just have regard to what's happening on a massive scale currently on at the road accident fund. Mr. Lebereko was here yesterday to attest to the fact that he was subjected to the RAF under these circumstances, and I would implore the members of this council to have regard and maybe address this issue to the department to have a second look at exactly what they are doing in terms of these RAF on the road campaigns of them. I'm not denying that under certain circumstances it is justified to give information to members of the public, but it was never the intention to administrate claims and to short sell plaintiffs because you're not properly adhering to this and have thousands of these claims prescribed in the hands of the Road Accident Fund. If we have to make a comparison between that particular attorney that Honourable Sibani was referring to not receiving his money, there are thousands of these plaintiffs currently at the Road Accident Fund that are expecting payment because they were approached by members of the Road Accident Fund with the promise of compensation, and in fact they will never see it because the Road Accident Fund is not abiding to their statutory duty to compensate these people. I'm just handing over to Advocate Van Jaarsveld just to add a few points of reference on this as well.
Thank you. And it is really just in addition to what Mr. Nellis said, just to deal with the issue of the relevance of the Satchel Commission. The Satchel Commission stands apart from the other commissions on a number of levels. The first one, it is the only commission that was brought into being and finalized its work on this issue after the Constitution came into being. It's the first commission that has accepted that this legislation forms part of the social security cluster, and all of their recommendations were made with that in mind. So from that point of view, it stands totally apart from the previous commission. And what is important is that it was given an implied approval by the Constitutional Court in the Law Society matter, and that the vision of the Satchel Commission was shared by the Constitutional Court. So that is virtually the most important commission of inquiry that the committee has at its disposal, and it is a very balanced recommendation. Just to add to the second point, it is an embarrassment to all of us as practitioners when we hear the news reports that Honourable Sibandi referred to. These are the bad apples in our profession that make us all look bad. Our profession, however, has had a huge role, not only worldwide, but also in South Africa, in bringing about even the transformation that Honourable Sibandi is talking about and the constitutional changes that we've had. And the point that I tried to make in the short little time that I had for my presentation is we can see that there is an intense feeling against the legal profession because of these incidents, which are incidents which the criminal prosecutors and which our profession's regulatory bodies have to deal with, and they deal with it on a daily basis. What has, however, happened when one looks at the bill and when one compares to what the Satchel Commission recommended with regards to dispute resolution is the verve with which there seems to be to get rid of the lawyers has meant that there is not a fair dispute resolution mechanism built into the bill. We understand that things are not going to go as they have done in the past, but we also have a duty to inform the committee that a proper dispute resolution mechanism is paramount and a sine qua non. The bill cannot proceed when the consumer protection dispute resolution mechanisms are much stronger. So, yes, we as practitioners also do not want to see these things, but we cannot see how this perversity can be legislated away to the detriment of the victim's right of access to justice. Thank you.
If I may probe further, dispute resolution mechanisms between who?
Between the victim and the administrator. The victim has to claim, in terms of perhaps, it has to claim from the administrator. The administrator makes all the decisions. The administrator is given wide discretions. The victim is not necessarily going to accept all of those decisions. As the bill presently reads, there is one internal appeal only against the decision to accept the claim or not. And after that, the victim is left with a narrow judicial review to the High Court, which only deals with whether the procedure was followed. the question as to whether the decision is ultimately right and wrong on the merits cannot be reviewed in such a narrow judicial review. I might give a further example, because fortunately this isn't the only work that I do. I'm also involved in a pension fund matter, where I can give the committee how that statute works. The pension fund adjudicator has a wide discretion to decide how to even conduct its own investigation when it receives a pension fund complaint. It can make any order that a court can make. This is not, we do not have something similar in the bill, and maybe because it doesn't lend itself to that. But the more important part is, once the complainant in a pension fund matter is through its dealings with the pension fund adjudicator, the Pension Fund Act allows it a wide appeal to the court, where it can re-bring its entire application, re-lead evidence, bring more evidence. That is sort of the apex example of a good dispute resolution mechanism. I've also had to deal with the Consumer Protection Act, which introduced a faultless liability for manufacturers for defective products. That act has a system whereby the complainant can go to the tribunal to get a ruling as to whether the manufacturer has transgressed the act. And once they have that, they have a free access to the court to go and prove the damages that they have suffered. Obviously, every field has its own requirements, but the point that I'm trying to make is the more consumer-friendly jurisdictions give the victim at the end of the process a wide form of dispute resolution which protects their rights to go to court. The internal remedies are intended to weed out, as I said, to weed out the non-contentious disputes without denying the victim the right to have their rights fully vindicated, or not vindicated, protected. And that is where the legal profession comes in as well. Lay people are always at a disadvantage if they do not have the access to a legal advice and a legal practitioner to assist. Thank you very much.
I hope you will be able to assist us by bringing the portion that you have spoken to on the dispute resolution mechanisms back to the committee. Honorable C. Bande, I wanted to move to what Honorable Tseko, I'm giving you a minute. Proceed, Honorable Sibande, a minute.
Chairperson, only one. Thank you very much for the response. But my concern, I was checking the background of where it started. Because the laws which we're talking about, which we're trying to transform, are the laws which started 1942. The sequence is as follows. 1942, motor vehicle accident insurance was established. 1996, they talk about the Act number 56 of 1996. And then 1999, Road Accident Fund was commission was appointed, and it was published in 2002. Nothing has done so far. So that those days we talk about the commissions and the processes which never take us through. And then also 2011, when it's about the police and the cabinet, 2011, which was published 2011. 2013, first version published and developed for public comments from 2013. And then also 2014, this was drafted and for the state law advisors and also to NADLEC. So now here is my worry, is that since then, the practical example was a lot of atrocity taking place with the Road Accident Fund. So if the system has failed, what do you do? Or to change it, isn't it? Road Accident Fund has failed. Number one, with a lot of deadlocks and also in how it was run up until recently, 2013 so far. The last time it was okay because some of the deadlocks, they tried to overcome it.
Thank you, Honorable Sivan.
Yes.
Honorable Tseko, you'll take what he has spoken to together with what Honorable Tseko will be raising.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, everyone. Chair, if I remember well, from the first day we were in Good Hope Center, there was a picture that I was disappointed with of a lady that was half naked, an African lady. Yesterday there was also a picture of another lady, because I saw the nails there. Today, there are case studies here. I'm not sure whether the presenters here and the ones that were in Good Hope want us to say African people are the most vulnerable, because they are always carrying their pictures here. What do they want us to say about them? I'm saying this because the person who is representing the fraternity and also the council, whatever, was there in the Good Hope Center, is also here today. I am worried because what was wrong with that lady was just below the knee at the back. What made them to take the picture that also showed a painting, a pink painting? In the process, we must also protect the dignity of individuals according to human rights. I'm not a legal person, but what was showed to us that day, yesterday, and your case study today make us think otherwise. At least you must have something to say. It means you are putting an emphasis that the African people, most of the blacks, are the only vulnerable, are the black people your only clients. Why don't you bring other pictures to this house? Because this is an open session, open to the public, open to whoever. How do you want people to view you as a fraternity? At least, Chair, even if it's an apology, but it must be made public in this house that at least as African people, as women, we must defend the rights of other people, please. Coming to what was discussed, I am interested in the presenters just highlighting the clauses that are unconstitutional, so that we take those clauses, what they have highlighted, back to our internal legal team. Because whatever that is unconstitutional sometimes will be tested in court. But our first step is to double check with our internal team to check whether when you are saying this clause is constitutional or unconstitutional, what do they know about that? Taking you back to the fact where you are saying the bill must consider the private health care costs. Where do you put the system that's going to be introduced soon? The healthcare system, what is it? The NHI. Where do you put NHI when you say, why do you always refer us to private costs? Is the private system the only health system in South Africa? Because you know there are other role players with regard to what we are discussing. And also the fact that you are also quoting that there's uncertainty around the issue of medical tariffs. If the minister can just disclose the tariff, will you agree with us when we say we can say yes to the bill tomorrow if that can be disclosed? And also on the issue that you mentioned, the date of the incident and the date of settlement, it makes me remember something that I wanted to ask yesterday. If you know of any of yourselves who pays interest after the settlement and the time the money is in your trust or wherever, do you pay the interest to the victims? If the scheme, if the fund settles the claim of the victim through you, the person who's representing, do you pay interest to the victim? And also, Chair, what else? At least let me give them chance to answer those. I'll come back if I have any minutes left. Thank you.
Chair, Honourable Member, I just want to start off by saying I apologise for my part in the picture yesterday, but I can confirm that it would never cross my mind that that would be an issue, because we are dealing with victims, and the point that we wanted to raise was the fact that the benefit scheme bill would not cater for these type of injuries. It was just, it could have been any colour. If it has to be reference taken to that, it could have been, it never crossed my mind that that should be an issue. As far as the Good Hope incident is concerned, I can honestly say the last time that I was there was a few years ago when I picked up my number for the Argus. I've never been to any of the sections or public engagements by, I don't know whether it was the Road Accident Fund. I've never been there in any other fashion.
Just quickly help you. It was the Law Society of South Africa which had a picture of a woman who was injured from below the knee, but what was shown was a picture which starts with a painting. Above the knee, there was nothing wrong, just below the knee, and probably we will have to engage the Law Society of Southern Africa, not yourself.
In any event, Honourable Member, I didn't have any knowledge of that, and as I say, I haven't attended any one of those, and I think that might have been before my time when I was involved at the LSSA, but I do apologise if you took offence or any of the other members took offence to that fact. The point that I just wanted to make was that I don't think it's reasonable to subject victims of any colour to the a situation in which you will have no recourse for compensation under those grave circumstances. Unfortunately, that's exactly what general damages are about, is to comfort the victims for life-changing injuries, and that is being taken away by a benefit scheme bill, and that was the point that I was trying to make. But again, I do apologise. As far as the medical tariff is concerned, I think we addressed the question yesterday as well as to the inference of private medical care. And again, I can just direct the Honourable Members back to the particular matter of the Law Society versus the Minister of Transport in another section thereof, in which the Honourable Judges confirmed that it is undisputable that imposing public health tariffs on road accident victims amounts to restricting them to a treatment at public institutions if they cannot fund the healthcare services themselves. In some instances, that restriction will be perfectly reasonable and adequate. However, the overwhelming and undisputed evidence demonstrates that the road accident victims who are rendered quadriplegic and paraplegic require specialized care for life, without which they can be life-threatening complications which, if unattended, lead to their inevitable demise. So again, this is not the Alice in Peas point of view. We are guided by case law and also the inference of the Department of Transport, in which they are offering a medical service, or as Mr. Pretorius has indicated, a medical aid which incentivizes being in an accident. And that was the point that we're trying to make. So the tariff is problematic. You were asking whether or not, if the Minister secured a tariff tomorrow, whether we would accept it. Obviously, it will contribute to us, all of us, being in a position to see whether or not the benefit scheme will be affordable or not. The tariff is not, in essence, speaks to two issues. One is what type of care these victims will be subjected to, and secondly, whether the bill would be affordable. And that's our two concerns, is if this is what is on offer, we have to make absolutely sure that the department will be able to own up on those promises. As far as the interest is concerned, Honourable Member, as attorneys, we do have trust accounts, so inevitably when money is paid into our trust accounts, it does, interest is borne on that money. Now, you can reach an agreement with your client in terms of which, depending on how long the money is going to be in the trust account, that money obviously bears interest in favor of the victim. Alternatively, as of recent, we having to wait 9 months for these payments to come from the road accident fund. The moment that the money comes into the trust account, the attorney is obligated to ensure that that money is paid over to the client as soon as possible. So indeed, interest will be paid in favour of the client, and obviously the road accident fund does cater at this point in time for interest on outstanding monies.
Honourable Teko?
Yes, Chair. Chairperson, let me go back to the case that was put in front, the case of Mr. Libereko, if I pronounce his name correct. It is said the loss of income there is around 1.4 million. What I don't get is, was he working? What is this 1.4 million based on? Why do you say under wraps you will be disadvantaged because of the 421? So can you talk more on that one? I also want to bring it to the attention of the House that the questions that we ask sometimes, we were never involved in any accident that involved the fact. This is experiences that we get from our constituencies. We are also people who are close to the victims or whoever has been affected in the community. Sometimes we don't ask, we don't just tamasak the questions that we ask. The questions that we ask are sometimes out of research or sometimes out of the experiences that we encounter in the community. Thank you, Chair.
Well, Chair, I will ask Mr. Pretorius to address the question on the comparison between the RAF and benefit scheme.
Thank you, Honourable Member. So under the Road Accident Fund, how the current calculation works is we, based on the expert input from the various medical professionals and specifically the industrial psychologist, a pre-accident scenario is determined whereby we look at the accident victim's earnings capacity before the accident occurred. So in this case, Mr. Libereko was employed with a certain income, which was expected to grow over time as he aged, which is a promotional increase over time. Subsequent to the accident, he was unable to work for 2 months, which presented an immediate loss for those 2 months. And when he returned to work, he was not able to earn at the same level as before the accident. So comparing these two scenarios, a loss was calculated in present value terms of 1.4 million rand. Under the Road Accident Benefit Scheme, there's quite a number of things in place that actually limit the compensation that will be paid to the victim. So in this case, there's a 75% of the pre-accident income that's being used. The monthly benefit, I've interpreted that he will only qualify for the long-term benefit, which only starts after 2 years. And then, of course, the road accident benefit scheme bill also limits these payments till age 60 years. So comparing the specified, the loss of income benefit that he would be able to receive under the road accident benefit scheme, I calculated that there's quite a significant difference because of the limitations that's included in the bill. So that's the difference between these two. I hope that answers your question.
Honourable Member, I can just maybe add to that the difference between the RAF situation and the benefit scheme situation is because there's no inflationary adjustments under the benefit scheme, and also career pathing, also, in other words, progression, is not taken account. So you introduce into the scheme on a certain level and there you stay. In terms of the current system, you can increase, like, because the idea under the current system is to financially put you in the position that you would have been in if we disregard the accident. Under the benefit scheme, the idea is not to compensate. And therein lies the difference. That's why there's a vast difference between the compensatory factor that we currently experience in relation to what we can expect under the benefit scheme bill, because again, it's the balancing act between what the scheme will be able to afford in relation to the amount of claims that they are going to receive under a no-fault system. It's a very sensitive balancing act. And that's why issues like funeral expenses and other factors are very sensitive to that scale, because if it tends to go to the more expensive part, then obviously the department and government will run the risk that the new scheme would probably be more expensive than we are currently seeing.
Another word, Buzzer?
No, thank you, Chair, and thanks to Advocate Gert and the team. Chair, I just want also to take an issue from what my colleague talked about in terms of the pictures and the case study. I would really request that the presenters in future must really be sensitive. South Africa is a diverse country and it's got demographics. Now, we don't want presentations here which then have some political connotations in terms of what is presented here. There is no way that in the case studies and the pictures, only the people that have to be presented, it's black and in particular the Africans. It sends a very wrong message. And it doesn't go well on us. It's got lots sending a wrong political message. So I'm asking that in future you should look as wide as you can when you make these examples, because as I'm saying, South Africa is a non-racial country and we subscribe to those principles. And we are also in a political, as much as we are dealing with the bill, but we are also in a political environment. And we must also make sure that political messages that are sent throughout are also correct and are also reflecting the true political nature of South Africa. So I really want to emphasize that one, Chairperson. The other issue that is a challenge, I think it was raised also yesterday. The presenters, they are also emphasizing their engagement and interaction with the department, which is fine, but I think let's not focus on that one. Here we are a portfolio committee who are engaging with you. We can't speak for the department. They will respond on their own time, but here we are engaging. We are lawmakers and we want to engage with each other. Friendly. Now, Chair, yesterday there was also a presentation where we had one of the organization that came boldly just said to us, REPS is not pro-poor, but it's pro-rich. Now, I just want to get your view on that one. Do you subscribe to that narrative or that kind of thought, because it didn't go well, you see, because there is no way that as the lawmakers we can create something or do something that is anti-poor. they are our first line that we defend, because they are the most vulnerable groups in South Africa. You have also said that certain elements of RAPs are unconstitutional. And I think that one also is very much important, because we will not engage in something that is unconstitutional. We want this engagement and also the process at the end of the day to produce something that is in line with the Constitution. So if there are those areas that we have picked up, I think it will be helpful for us to actually identify them. You have done that, but maybe when you present your proposals as a solution, you then actually highlight those areas so that we will then verify it with our legal minds as well, because it's not all what we are saying, we take it as it is, you know, as the gospel. But we've got also our learned friends on our sides, which then have to look at that, and then you engage at the legal level and see whether you agree, whether your pronunciations is correct, or maybe their views are not are also correct or not. Chair, there was also an emphasis in the opening statements that the bill is implied actually to be a balancing act. Now, I just want to check, is a balancing act between what? Between the limited resources and also the human rights and the human dignity. So I just want, what is it supposed to be balancing specifically? And then there was also an assertion that says most of the recommendations of the commission has not been considered, and particularly those that don't favor the administrator. I think that's a very also loaded statement. But what I just want to check, are we as a portfolio committee and the department compelled to implement the recommendations as they are? Because to me, recommendations are recommendations. They are not decisions. And if we have to implement the recommendations as they are, and then what's the role of the portfolio committee and the department? Where do we then allow the space then to apply our minds? So I think if you can also guide us on that one. Chair, I think I had the recommendations and the proposals that were put on the screen. But what we are actually saying in a nutshell, you are saying that more work needs to be done, more research has to be done. And I think that maybe that's what we need to look at. And then maybe I think if you can then suggest, how do you see us doing that? How do we do it? And who are the role players and the stakeholders that you think must be involved in that exercise? And remember that when we are doing these things, there are time frames also. And what is your recommended time frame that the whole exercise could be done and be concluded? And I think that will assist us a lot, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honourable Member, I will deal with the matters that falls within my knowledge, and the rest I will hand over to my colleagues. Again, I want to reiterate that I do apologise. It was never my intention to paint a picture other than the one I wanted to convey the message on the general damages part of it. Moving on from there, there was a contention that you've made that some of the other speakers yesterday mentioned that the bill is not pro-poor but it's pro-rich. I think that might be a misunderstanding, because the bill definitely speaks to some issues, and the rich will definitely be excluded from the bill. So there doesn't have to be any concern as far as that is, that issue is raised. If you earn over and above the cap, which I think is 250,000 to 255,000 rand, you will get no benefit from the benefit scheme. The department will tell you that you will get medical treatment, but that would have already been catered for in terms of your medical aid, because if you earn that type of salary, you'll probably have a medical aid. So the benefit scheme bill is of no use for anybody earning over and above a certain cap. So the rich is excluded as a rule, so there's no issue there. The balancing act that I'm referring to is the sensitive balancing of how much money is available in terms of the fuel levy in relation to catering for a medical scheme on a no-fault basis. And that's the inference made to a balancing act, because the moment that you introduce or want to add benefits in favour of the victims, there's a premium to be paid. And the concern is, if that premium increases, the scale tips towards the unaffordable, which will lead to victims' benefits being reduced, or, it could also mean that we'll have to pay more taxes in order to afford the benefit scheme bill at the end of the day, because it will be fully funded by the petrol levy or the current levy. As far as the solutions, I'll address the issue of the Social Commission to the Council or to Advocate Van Jaarsveld. But as far as the solutions are concerned and guidance in terms of what we can do to reach common ground, I think for one, there should be a peer review of the calculations that are being made. My concern was that yesterday we were told that we will not have, we will not be privy to the tariff or the tariff structure, which is of a concern, because there can't be any question of a peer review if, again, the department cherry picks what information they're going to afford the public to be able to assist in affording guidance for the best possible solution. As far as the Statutory Commission is concerned, I'll ask Advocate Van Jaarsveld to address that issue.
Thank you. I just want to start with an earlier point which was also made by the Honourable Member with regards to the opinion referring to issues that might be unconstitutional. I'm going to make the written submission, as I said, available. The committee will see that it follows the process that a court would follow in adjudicating on whether a legislative measure is constitutional or not. It deals firstly with the rationality review, which is simply a question as to whether the measure is legitimately and logically linked to a government purpose. Because that's the first level of the threat of the test. Thereafter, there is a question as to whether there are human rights contained in the Chapter 2 in the Bill of Rights which are being contravened. And thereafter follows the reasonableness test, which is aimed at seeing whether those impairments or I wouldn't use the word infringement, because sometimes these infringements are not unconstitutional. That is what the reasonable test is all about, to say if the limitation of the right is justifiable. In the Law Society matter, the court found an infringement of Section 12. It assumed an infringement of Section 25. Section 12, it was an infringement for purposes of abolishing the residual common law claim. It assumed an infringement of Section 25, which is the section that entrenches the right to property. That was for purposes of the cap in the loss for loss of earnings and the like. It also found an infringement of Section 27 with access to health care for purposes of the tariff. With regards to the first two, being the infringement of Section 12 and the assumed infringement of Section 25, the court was comfortable to find that the government purpose on the reasonableness review as well was sufficient. With regards to the tariffs, however, it felt that infringement was not constitutional, and it struck the regulation down because of that. So the written submission will follow the same line. What I must add is these are two different statutes, of course. The new Act, which was before court there, was in place. The bill is much more limiting, and that is why I also in the submission states that there are some other
rights that are now becoming open to being queried, in the right to dignity in particular, and the right of access to justice. It, in the Constitution, it's called access to courts, but the bill, the section itself refers to tribunals, extracurial tribunals. So it's more proper to call it access to justice, because that's really what it is at its heart. Having said that, that is where the Balancing Act also comes in. This legislation moves away from a very wide remedy that the old-fashioned common law view was that the widest possible protection must be given to the claimant. A whole number of limitations are being introduced. It was introduced into the new act, and it's extended into the bill. So the scope for limitations of human rights are becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and the justification for that is the funding crisis that the bill has. So that is the Balancing Act as well. The available resources as against the rights that the victims have in terms of the Constitution. And we are aware that this is a difficult Balancing Act to carry through. That is why, in my submission, the Satchel Commission's recommendations are a very useful starting point, because from reading them, it is clear that the Balancing Act was attempted, that it is well-reasoned, the research was done by that commission in jurisdictions outside of South Africa. They didn't just take every submission that was given to them and accepted it. They were robust in how they approached what was put before them. And as I said earlier in a response to one of the other questions, that is the only commission that we have that has been done in our constitutional age, and that is a very significant part of it. I agree, we cannot say to the committee that you are compelled to follow what a commission of inquiry says, because that's also not the purpose of the commission of inquiry, as the honourable member correctly points out. The point that we are making is there is much of value in that report, and it is somewhat disconcerting, I have to say, that when one compares the report with the bill, it appears that more of what was recommended in favour of the victim did not make its way into the bill, and more of what is in favour of the administrator is there. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, can I just respond in terms of a time frame? You asked how long it would whether we would be available. Obviously, depending on the availability of the parties involved, I think from the Law Society's point of view and the different stakeholders, we would be prepared to engage any department, to try and resolve and obviously come up with a good law, as we were told yesterday.
Thank you very much. We are going to pass and go to the human rights lawyers. Are they here? Let me once more thank the Law Society of the Northern Provinces. We believe that you will be able to provide us with the outstanding information on issues of dispute resolution mechanism. Oh, I thought you were not here. We are running behind schedule. We need to be mindful of the fact that by 3 o'clock the President will be presenting his budget. 2 o'clock the President will present his budget debate, so we need to fast track. Before I release you, Honorable Ramatlakhan.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I will be short, given the time. Maybe the presenter could maybe on some of them respond in writing. I just want to find out your comment on section on clause 27(4) in the current bill. Maybe you can make a submission on that in the interest of time. The actuarial presentation worries me, because the presentation is, and it said so in writing, about investigation that you need in respect to a number of issues, including the tariffs, the uncertainty, the calculation uncertainty, that whole area. there's a degree of uncertainty. We did make a point before that we are dealing with a bill. There is going to be another process of determining the tariffs. So I'm not quite sure that presentation actually raised more questions than the solution. And then I must thank you for being absolute honest. You have not painted a picture that favors any about it. Then I want to just ask the advocate, the Central Commission does talk about the consideration of the issue raised, which may be linked or must be linked to Social Security Network of South Africa. And Special Judge makes the point about no fault, that the fault issue must not play any role in determining, so that the whole thing is put aside. And I think the bill as it stands seeks to consider all those issues. In the 7 area of recommendation by the judge, and I think it was fairly considered issues, because in those 7 he talks about moderate, this whole thing about the moderate instead of just being, in terms of the payment of the consideration, that the operative word is the moderate when you consider all the issue of the settlement. And the South African context he raises as part of the consideration. I haven't heard the argument that seems to suggest that the bill as presented as table is not considering the South African context. I haven't heard that argument arguing against that. And the whole thing about proportionality and equitability, that is things that the judges raise as part of those kind of 7 areas of concern that should be taken on board. And of course the whole thing about impartiality or the impartiality, affordability raises, affordability linking that with affordability of the funds in terms of the country, sustainability issues in terms of going forward, if it's sustainable in terms of efficiency, linking it, continuous linking it to social security of the country. Now, I am raising these issues that perhaps because in your presentation you have not directly said to us in respect of these 7 areas, except to mention the judge in a broad stroke, haven't said in specific term, these are the pitfall, the reasonability, these are the pitfalls in respect of sustainability or even linking it to social security. The previous presentation we raised this issue that 65 and linking the 65 with it, there was an issue about equitability and the issue about whether that is in keeping with what the lifestyle is, if I use a different term. But perhaps these suggestions and recommendation from the judge, so far where I'm sitting, I see that a substantial number of them have been taken into account, except the point, the sticky point about the one about general damage issue that keep coming up. But perhaps in your considered view, perhaps afterwards, think about it as to what would be the middle point, what will be the middle point around that particular question. And I guess that time does not allow And constitutionality is probably just assumptions that is being raised here, because that has not been tested, except to make a reference to something that is not quite the same as this one. So I think that there is a limitation of the constitution, and there is a test to do that. So I think to maybe in your, we did ask the other gentleman, other advocate, Leonard advocate, to submit as well that argument. We'll consider it when it comes. In a nutshell, Chair, what I'm saying is that in the presentation, if we could be helped to understand this argument of judge, central, that the bill is deviating miles away from it, because I haven't seen it. If you could do that in your submission, I'm sure it will be helpful so that for us to be able to consider it as well in going forward. Thank you, Chair.
I will, that is not in the opinion at present, but I do understand exactly what the Honourable Member is referring to, and it is something that can be linked. I'm not necessarily saying what my conclusion is, but I do understand which portion the Honourable Member is referring to, and that it relates to the ultimate question as to whether the limitations are going to be justifiable. So I will certainly address that in this submission as well. Thank you.
Honourable Member, just with reference to Section 27, I think that was one of the issues that were raised with the Council last week. So I'll just find out from their party how far it is with that opinion as to not to duplicate any opinion. So if that would be an order, we'll just confirm. Otherwise, we'll submit a comment in writing as well.
Honourable, are you okay? Okay. Honourable Shalembe, are you fine? Okay, thank you very much. Earlier on, I had said that we will be calling the human rights lawyers, and we thank you for the inputs. Your work beyond this is more extensive. As Honourable Ramatlakala had indicated, if you can be able to indicate further the deviation that is there, the dispute resolution, some of the unconstitutional clauses that you have indicated, if you can highlight them on the bill, we would really appreciate. And probably by next week we'll be finishing the public hearings here in Parliament. We would really appreciate if we can get those probably by first week of June, so that we are able to know how to take the process forward. Thank you very much. You are list human rights lawyers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Line whip for you as well. We have to be in the house at 2. I don't think this is not on. So I'm saying that we must continue with the lawyers for human rights and make an arrangement with the litigation centre. Because I don't see us getting through two of these with properly questioned process to properly ask these questions, these people. And I'm asking that in the future we stop this. I've complained about this in the past, and Valerie keeps on doing the same old thing. We rush through it as the poor last person that happens to be on the third on the agenda, then rushes there with rushing through, and it's unfair. And then we're not doing the process justice.
Relax.
Relax.
When you leave here, there's massages and what have you out there. You can go in and
change the massage. Sorry, actually, it's not your response. There is not
relax.
On. I'm not about relax. It's about doing this properly. And we this is typical that we keep on rushing these things.
These people
probably have travelled halfway down the country. And you want them to sit for an hour and a half when we're rushing the thing through?
No, honourable member. I'm saying relax. Because we definitely are going to be taking the two presentations. And the more you talk, the more we procrastinate. Instead of us going into the crux of the matter, you keep on making us procrastinate. And I don't take your time. Yep. We are going to be calling the lawyers for human rights to make a presentation. Since last week, we have been making sure that we give you 30 minutes for your presentation, and another 30 minutes is given to the honourable members so that they can be able to present and ask you questions, and you will be interacting. But it doesn't mean when we say 30 minutes for the discussions and questions, it means exactly that. Without much ado, I want you to introduce yourself, ma'am, and start with your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, and good morning to all the other Honourable members of the Parliamentary Committee. I confirm that I will be making joint submissions on behalf of Lawyers for Human Rights and the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants. My name is Kai-Ann Leung. I'm an attorney employed with Lawyers for Human Rights. To start off with, I'd like to just give you a bit of background with regards to the two joint organizations. Firstly, Lawyers for Human Rights is an independent human rights organization with a 39-year track record of human rights activism and public interest litigation in South Africa. LHR uses the law as a positive instrument for change and to deepen the democratization of South African society. LHR has programs in prison reform, environmental rights, refugee and migrant rights, land and housing, and strategic litigation, with offices located throughout the country. Our refugee and migrant rights program sees between 10,000 to 15,000 asylum seekers and refugee clients per year in its four law clinics located in Pretoria, Johannesburg, Durban, and Messina. And we welcome this opportunity to make submissions. On behalf of the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, they are a national network of organizations working with refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants in the country. Their mandate is the promotion and protection of rights of asylum seekers, refugees, and migrants, and this is achieved through advocacy work, capacity building, coordination and network building, research and promoting information sharing with civil society organizations, which focuses on discussing challenges facing non-nationals. LHR and CORMSA submits the bill in its current form will create serious hardships and unfairness for undocumented migrants who are excluded from the protection and benefits which are outlined in this bill. Given the context of the nature of the work that we do with the two organizations, we'd like to address our submissions on the focus on impact of the bill on undocumented migrants. LHR and CORMSA also contend that this is inconsistent with the ethos and vision of the Constitution of South Africa, including the Bill of Rights and the White Paper on International Migration. To quote page 3 of the International White Paper, what South Africa urgently needs in a highly connected world is a robust, progressive vision of the benefits of a well-managed international migration. This vision must be based on the crucial contribution inward and outward of migration that it makes and will make it growing our economy and to the transformation of Africa. The white paper contends that it is neither desirable nor possible to stop or slow down international migration. To start off with, honourable members, there are significant numbers of asylum seekers, refugees and migrants, both undocumented and documented in this country. We further note that the current asylum protection system is in crisis and is effectively non-functional. This is partly due to large numbers accessing the system. However, it goes beyond just access. There's also indicative lack of capacity within the Department of Home Affairs to deal effectively and efficiently with claims for asylum, a lack of resources to allow for departmental officials to conduct their work independently and fairly, as well as the widespread and endemic issue of corruption. This corruption occurs mainly at the refugee reception centres, but also within South African police services and, in some cases, immigration officials. No single issue has affected access to the migration system, including both immigration and asylum, more than corruption. It is unfortunately an omnipresent and daily experience of non-nationals and, of course, South Africans as well. In a report titled A Queue Here for Corruption, LHR and the African Centre for Migration Society, ACMS, based at the University of Johannesburg, conducted a survey of 928 asylum seekers and refugees at the country's 5 refugee reception offices. The survey found that there was an issue of pervasive corruption within the asylum system. In total, 20% of respondents nationally had experienced corruption and were asked to pay money for services, which were supposed to be free. The number shot up to 51% once inside the queues in Marabastad, which is one of the refugee reception offices in Pretoria. Nationally, 13% of the respondents have experienced corruption within the refugee reception areas. Again, this is worse at Marabastad, with 31% experiencing corruption. 13% of the respondents were asked to pay an official at the border. The impact of corruption impending impedes access to the refugee reception offices, including over half the respondents from the Pretoria Refugee Office, and many struggle to get access to legal documentation. In addition, since 2011, 3 refugee reception offices were closed in Cape Town, Port Elizabeth and Johannesburg. Now, the legality of these closures were challenged in the High Court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, and even in the Constitutional Court, and to date, regrettably, the Ministry of Home Affairs has been unable to open the refugee reception offices despite court orders compelling them to do so. Furthermore, the immigration laws currently do not provide mechanisms for low-skilled migrants to be able to regularize their immigration status, regardless of the time that they have resided in the country. This leaves a number of migrants, including SADC citizens, without the ability to obtain any kind of immigration status. We're concerned that these provisions in the bill would prejudice, in particular, undocumented migrants and make no provision for their care and treatment should they become injured in a motor vehicle accident. Very briefly, I would like to refer you to the additional submissions, which take on the form of parliamentary answers by the Minister of Home Affairs, dated November 2016, labeled LHR2. And responses also dated February 2017. Another snapshot of the challenges within the asylum process is that there is a huge backlog within the appeals of the Refugee Appeal Board. This is relevant because many people are left without recourse often in conjunction with corruption that's happening at the refugee offices in finalizing their status and actually getting the correct documentation. As noted by the Minister of Home Affairs in 2016, it's estimated that the refugee appeal has around 145,414 appeals cases nationally. And in 2017 of February, the answer shot up to an estimated backlog of 258,232 cases. And they also acknowledged that there's institutional incapacity in this regard, and that is evident and multifaceted. Now, this institutional capacity cannot be a problem that they acknowledge they can alleviate on their own. It was also noted that since May 2016, there was no decisions taken before the refugee appeal members due to resignation of 3 members, and at that point it was unclear how many appeal hearings were improperly constituted. This is just a snapshot of further challenges within the asylum process and for undocumented migrants that are trying to regularize themselves. In addition to the lack of will of certain departments within Home Affairs, there in our submission appears to be a sense of impugned institutional xenophobia. And this is in conjunction, an example of this would be the Operation Fiela operation that took place in 2015. I understand that there's a second operation that commenced this year, but I'd like to reference the first Operation Fiela, where the operation itself, while they were aimed at addressing the safety concerns of the citizens of the country, it echoed this xenophobic and exclusionary process where hundreds of foreign nationals were unlawfully arrested and detained across the country. And it is our submission that this behavior often perpetuates the belief that undocumented people are the cause of crime and fuels hatred and directs violence targeted at less foreign nationals. I've already addressed the issue of lack of access to the refugee reception offices due to corruption and the incapacity of the Department of Home Affairs in dealing with these applications. This has, in essence, created, whether it be willful, it has created a sense that Department of Home Affairs has actually created undocumented migrants in the process. If the bill is passed in its current form, the bill will likely be challenged because of its constitutionality. And this would also lead to unnecessary litigation and costs against the state. I would like to refer to one specific recommendation by the South African Human Rights Commission in relation to the Commission of Inquiry after the first xenophobic attacks in 2008. And that is that there seems to be a misconception that relates to the immigration status of an individual that precedes the Constitution in determining the rights of people living in South Africa. On the contrary, the preamble to the Constitution declares that the country belongs to all who live in it, not just its citizens. And it states that human rights are applicable to all people. This includes the right to life, freedom of security, freedom from discrimination on any grounds, and freedom from arbitrary eviction or deprivation of property. I'd like to now move on to, having given you a context of the challenges and an overview of the challenges undocumented migrants, in particular asylum seekers, are facing currently, I'd like to refer to 3 specific sections that we have made submissions on. Firstly, under Chapter 5, the liability of the administrator and other persons in regards to the limitation of administrator's liability. Section 27.4 clearly states that if at the time of the road accident an injured person or deceased breadwinner was not a citizen or permanent resident of the Republic or holder of a valid permit or visa issued in terms of the Immigration Act or the Refugees Act, the liability of the administrator is limited to payment for the provision of emergency health care services provided such persons or deceased breadwinner while he or she was alive. So Section 27.4 limits the benefits to emergency health care only, and in particular for foreigners who are deemed illegally in the Republic. And as I've already alluded through my illustrations and submissions, many of these foreign nationals are not deliberately and willfully undocumented. It is anticipated that this section will impact many cases and create hardships as a result of this exclusion. We would like to jointly, as CORMSA and LHR, place on record our serious concerns about this specific section, as there are a great number of asylum seekers who fail to have their permits renewed on time due to no fault on their part, but rather on the ineffective or corrupt asylum system as indicated. This would equally apply to migrants, including migrant children that are either undocumented or stateless. They would thus be unable to seek health care, and they would not be able to receive compensation for injuries suffered. And the changes do not take into account the migration reality in this country, and it could potentially impact thousands of people without access to life-saving medical treatment and care. We submit that this section offends the morals of the public. This bill should not be used as a monitoring or conditioning of migration mechanism or tool. And it cannot be seen that this bill reflects some current trends of some departments within government. And we would implore this committee to take back to the Ministry of Transport to redirect its good intentions to a scheme that is reasonable, equitable, affordable, sustainable, in line with the ethos of our Constitution. Our second point of submission relates to Section 28 in relation to the exclusion of liability of owner, driver, and employer of driver. As mentioned and discussed previously in other presentations, the common law rights of the innocent road accident victim to recover damages suffered by him or her, which are not covered by the statutory scheme, have been abolished, and road accident victims who are injured may be denied life enhancement benefits. The removal of the common rights that allow a victim to pursue claims directly against a perpetrator for damages and pain or suffering opens up the space for litigation and challenging the constitutionality of this. And we would foresee that it may very well be challenged on its constitutionality. The removal of the common law right to recover general damages to road accident claims would be regarded as unfair, unreasonable, and extremely prejudicial to all those present in South Africa. Finally, the last point we wish to raise is the issue of funeral benefits under Chapter 6, where it mentions the flat rate of 10,000 Rand has been replaced by a prescribed sum of payment made to a family member or a funeral director. So while it mentions that if it's impractical to wait to claim for funeral benefits, an administrator may independently pay either to an immediate family member or after consultation with a family member, or if unable to locate a family member without consultation, to a funeral director the prescribed sum. We submit that it's currently unclear to us what that prescribed amount would be and whether or not that amount would be justifiable or satisfactory to address the needs of those who have been involved as victims. The amount awarded may be inadequate to actually cover the cost of transporting a body of a deceased migrant worker, for example, for burial. And the family of a foreigner without a visa or permit killed in an accident would be denied compensation for the cost of repatriating the body or for the funeral. There is no indication of who would be responsible for the funeral or repatriation costs in the case of an undocumented person. It's unclear to us whether the bill would mean to apply that these groups or categories of persons would have no means to cover these costs. And this section, we submit, offends the right to dignity, which is constitutionally protected for every person in this country, as dignity is not limited to citizens and documented foreign nationals only. In conclusion, the aspects of the bill commented on the submissions by LHR and COMSA go against the ethos and the vision of the Constitution, which frames a rallying call for transformation and redress of wrongs of capitalist apartheid. Our constitutional design is supposed to be emphatically transformative, and it's meant to migrate us from a murky and brutish past to an inclusive future animated by values of human decency and solidarity. It contains a binding consensus, one of a blueprint of what a fully transformed society should look like. And I'm quoting former Deputy Justice Moseneke. It is the submission of LHR and COMSA that this bill should take into account the history of the migrant labor system, which saw the exploitation through a capitalistic economic system of black labor institutionalized and enforced through the divide and rule of policies of the system of apartheid. Dating back to 1886, with the discovery of gold on the Witwatersrand, systems to control African labor were put in place with strict regulations to prevent them setting permanently in South Africa. A failure to recognize this and take this into account in formulating a policy such as the current bill under consideration could be argued to be unconstitutional. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. There we are. Honourable Ramatakana, you'll be the first. Honourable Mpanza, Honourable Sibande, in that order.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I thank the presentation. Thank you very much for the Human Rights Lawyer presentations. The presentation is a little bit similar to the one that we've had before. So I won't have a long questions to pose, but just maybe to help us, because we do want to address the weaknesses that is contained in the bill. But do you think the law that we are busy with now should be fairly clear and specific? Or do you want to see that we come up with the law that is fairly general, that include issues that you have raised, some of them that you have raised, which got to do with different legislation. Different legislation in the sense that home affairs is also involved. The issue about the backlog, I think, is a central theme of the presentation, that as a result of the backlog, we have people that are undocumented. But you don't also mention that generally, the fact that if there's a backlog does not equal granting status. It's not given that all the people that have applied would get the status in terms of a different act. So how do you suggest we insert or we make recognition at least of the backlog? Should we say in the Act, as a result of the backlog, this law recognizes that there is this backlog, and therefore those who are undocumented henceforth will benefit equally in terms of this Act? That's what I'm just trying to find out from you. And if it's so, you're talking about undocumented people, how do you then trace the undocumented people in the case of the benefit? How do you do that? I have a picture of what you're talking about, of quite general law that at the end of the day you're unable even to implement that part that you're worried about. Because otherwise, if nobody has a paper, how do you then trace? Who then takes responsibility for that? You're asking the question, it's not clear who takes the responsibility. But because you are making a presentation, you should say in your considered view this is what should happen. Because we have asked that to make a comment. Don't you think that some of the things that you've raised, for an example, you raised the issue about the funeral scheme. I mean, the funeral payout, it says something like, it will be prescribed. Don't think that that section is empowering enough for a minister to come up with a detailed regulation. Do you think that what's prescribed today should be cast in concrete in the Act, or should be something that can be reviewed and amended from time to time, and therefore the regulation may be a best place for this to happen. In other words, prescribing means the minister must come up with a regulation that would say the funeral would be X amount of money, which would have to be basically tested, calculated based on the whatever the bill comes in at. So don't you think that? Then, Chair, I am worried about this notion of exclusion. I'm worried about it because it seems to paint us into a position that we no longer subscribe to human rights, we no longer believe in a constitution. But if we make the law, we're making the law for South Africa. It's applicable in South Africa. It is not applicable to anywhere else. Like any other country makes a law for their country, it's applicable to that country. And has some limitation. And the limitation is already recognized in the Constitution. Why should you think that this act should not have a limitation for the non-South African? Otherwise, we must take the burden of paying a citizen of another country using the South African taxpayers for that. What is the case study for that argument? Do you have maybe a place where you can point us to say, I've got 10 countries in the world that does this? If you are in America, you benefit all of these. If you are in UK, you benefit of all these, irrespective whether you have a paper or not, so that we avoid the generality. Because here we want to have a specific law that is understandable what we want to achieve with it. So that's really my difficulties in following. I don't want to take the long road in the discussion, but I think that the issue about what you are bringing to our attention, yes, we'll take that into consideration. But the number of pitfalls in the submission, it's a presentation of generality, not actually helping us to arrive at this. But as I say, maybe you should help us to explain that the general damage. We've asked someone to think about this. We said, if you say not, are you talking third party to pursue claims? Because if you're saying that, and I don't think that is correct that the common law right would be overwritten by this, but maybe you can help us to understand why you say so. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Your first question was, do you think that the law should be interpreted specifically or generally and open to interpretation? I think it's first and foremost important to look at the objective of what the RABS is trying to achieve. And if I would like to recall, I think Honourable Sibanda had mentioned it is supposed to be transformative, and you know it needs to find amicable solutions and against past atrocities. So if you take into consideration our submissions, considering the economic development that South Africa is built on using migrant labour, considering the fact that there is a failure in the asylum system application process, that is not the backbone of our argument, but it is one huge chunk of our reasons and submissions why people are actually finding themselves in an undocumented space due to no fault of their own. I would submit that it is important for us to always uphold the constitution in which we are striving to achieve, that transformative society, a society that's inclusive for all. So to answer that first part of your question, I think it's important to have clear objectives within the way you're drafting the bill, but it has to be done in line and tested against the constitutional values, the Bill of Rights. And yes, I agree that there is a limitation clause that can be considered, whether or not an issue is justifiable. But in my mind, as a human rights practitioner, I cannot justify that an individual that has found themselves to be undocumented at the time and may have a family that they will need to support, and has that family has found this breadwinner, let's just say hypothetically, to have lost their life, is now unable to claim anything except the fees that were dealt with in terms of the emergency medical treatment. I think that in itself is in my view, not justifiable. With regards to going back to the objectives, I understand there's already been a lot of debate on the Satchwell Commission. There were a number of recommendations made on that commission, but to summarize, one of the key things is that the recommendations was that any future drafting on the road accident benefit scheme needs to be, as I mentioned before, it needs to be justifiable and equitable, and it needs to be harmonious with the objectives of our constitution. In terms of the funeral scheme, I understand that it is a tricky balancing act to say what amount is exactly suitable or appropriate in each such scenario. So whilst we are raising this concern that there has been an alteration from 10,000 Rand to a prescribed amount, we are at no means indicating to Parliament what that amount needs to be. And I think in this case, I agree with you that there should be some direction on what that amount, a guideline on what that amount can be. But I don't think it should always be a set amount. I think a person's personal circumstances need to be considered. So to answer that portion of your question, I think it can be a policy, that tariff structure that you work around, but it's not a finite amount. So we are not saying that 10,000 Rand should be the golden standard. We're merely saying that these factors of, if you're dealing with a migrant that has passed away and there are funeral expenses to be involved, that these factors should also be considered when drafting that policy as well. On the notion of exclusion, Honourable Member, I fully agree that I do not believe that it was the intention of the drafters to actually be outright exclusionary, or at least in my humble opinion, I would hope that was not the objective. But again, when you're dealing with the limitation in terms of Section 36 and whether or not it's justifiable in excluding undocumented migrants or asylum seekers that have found themselves to be undocumented, I think the limitation, and if you compare it and balance it with what the adverse consequences will be on the individuals and their families, it is a very heavy burden on the individual, the family, or the victim. And I cannot reconcile with the fact that this would be a justifiable exclusion. I cannot speak to an exact study of which countries do not or do include undocumented migrants or non-nationals in the country who can benefit from the scheme, but I can speak to the fact that our current road accident fund is based on the fact that everyone who utilizes fuel as a means of transport has to pay a levy, and that levy is attributed to the road accident fund. And this would include migrants as well, whether or documented or undocumented. People have to have a means of using transport, and they too directly contribute to the road accident fund. So I would argue that it would be unjustifiable, again, Honourable Member, if one would be contributing to that scheme but is unable to claim in the event that something horrific would have to happen or fall upon them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honorable Ramatlaka, you still want to make your follow-up? Let it be quick.
I hear you, madam, but are you now suggesting with that last part in short that if it's justifiable, the point that you're making about fuel levy, is it your view, therefore, that in the legislation we should put a clause that is saying something like anybody who pays their fuel levy or who buys diesel or buys petrol, by effect of buying petrol or diesel, you are covered in terms of this particular act. Is that your view that we should phrase it something like that? In that way, it's a cash on phrase that you put into the law. So that is your view. And just the last part, this bill has a clear objective. Are you arguing that the object of the bill is in conflict with what the constitution or constitution of our country is? If so, in which way? Because there is an objective here. So everything that flows in the bill is taking into account what the objective of it is. And is it your view that you may want to think about it? The fact that we have a law, and that law must not be changed because it existed from many years. Is that your view that we should just continue with it? Because it's almost suggesting that you say it should.
Thank you, Honorable Ramatlaga. I think in summary, to answer most of your questions, I'm not suggesting that a provision that states whoever pays a fuel levy should be a beneficiary. I mean, that is one means of addressing it, but I think an easier win, if you will, would be to address Section 27(4), which specifically excludes undocumented foreign nationals from being able to claim benefits. I think that would be a more straightforward and easier determination. We are assuming, and I think the Southern African Litigation Center will deal with numbers a little bit later in their presentation, but you're assuming that by being inclusive, you're suddenly going to open this old age argument that, you know, you're opening floodgates for people to claim. And I do not agree in this submission, in that particular sense, that by being inclusive of undocumented foreign nationals, you're going to see a rise and bankruptcy of the fund itself. I do not believe that.
Running out of time?
Yeah, but this part is quite important because it deals with Law 7274. If you say we should amend it, to say what? Because that is beginning to limit. It has got a limitation in it. So if you say we should amend it, to say what? To say including the undocumented asylum seekers? Is that what you're suggesting? And if you say so, don't you think that there is a flip side of it? And flip side of it is that it has a consequence, which that is directly financial. So I'm losing you in terms of the argument. Please help me to understand. Because at the end, your input is going to be important in fixing what we need to fix.
That's okay.
Yes. Certainly. Honorable Ramatlaka, I understand that Section 24 deals with the limitation of the liability. It is, I submit that it is a difficult task to ascertain how one would remedy this liability. But I stand by our submission that one should not be excluding undocumented foreign nationals from being able to claim additional benefits if they are involved in a motor vehicle accident. We submit that the provision of emergency healthcare treatment is not sufficient for those categories. So whether or not you need to redraft the entire limitation of the administrator's liability or strike it off completely, that is something I leave in the hands of Parliament. But as it stands, Section 27.4 is problematic because it is discriminatory against undocumented migrants. And I submit it is not a justifiable discrimination.
Thank you, Honorable Sibande.
I vote, Chairperson. Chairperson, please, I wanted to appeal. I know my appeal is one. You see, with this document, an ordinary person, if he can get this document.
Which document are you
referring to? The presentation. The presentation from the human rights lawyers. You see, here we are talking about the issue of rights being. In terms of transport, I want you to be honest with you, ma'am. But if you can peruse from page one to the last page, even with the issue of the present, the questions from Parliament were specific for Home Affairs, correct? The question which you attached here. So my worry is this, Chairperson. South Africa is a sovereign country. First thing, it's our country, and then you come with SADC and OPOP, etc. And then, in some of your examples which you put, I wanted to give you the other, like here, Chairperson, what is my appeal? Is that, unfortunately, you don't have numbers where you were referring to some, even to Isilo, and some of the things with the Meran, Heaven, Masham, and some of, yes, you are right, in those categories, but in this one, let me put an example, my argument, to those who say some, not all of them, the foreign people are causing problems. What about Yanus Walush, who killed Chris Hani, was a foreign person? What about the issue of this guy who Anonymous Mate, a kingpin, was a foreign person? I can put a lot of examples. And then here comes again. You see, in the things which you are referring to, let me put an example in Swaziland. In South Africa, we have a pension fund. In Swaziland, they do have Idlela Ngongeni, of which their own pension fund. Do you mean that we mustn't have anything from South Africa first? We must accommodate? No. It starts somewhere first before you add some of the people. Yes, I agree. We are members subscribing to SADC. We are subscribing to PAP. We are subscribing to Africa as a whole. But what about our laws? What about us? I will accept where you are saying, if you can point exactly what is unconstitutional. Because with this, we're supposed to have laws. What type of a country without laws? That's my argument. What type of a country without laws? And then, Chairperson, hey, this thing. And in future, you see, I'm scared. Whereby, like the people whom you mention here as attributors of xenophobic, this thing was cleared long ago. Well, I also agree with the ministers which are here in Parliament, but people who are outside from Parliament, you mention them here. I'm scared when some of the people can get this document and interpret them with their own ways, while it's not us. It's you who presented this document. So, some of these things must be corrected. To me, there is no difference with the examples which was highlighted by Mukwege and some of my colleagues about the issue of the pictures which are brought to us. People must be sensitive when they present something, as we are sensitive to. Don't have to present, you know, like that. No, no, no. South Africa also, lastly, is not a dumping place, whereby we need, because even those people, if you talk about illegal people, it covered a lot of people, because even when they are, we agree with the deadlocks, they are deadlocks, but some of the measures which have been corrected, they verify before they give them permission. South Africa do verify, because some of these people, if you don't verify, we can have some challenges in South Africa, international, in terms of the international norms and standards. As you are exactly talking about the issue of international. Last example, I don't want to go details, that the thing we were arguing here about some of the people who want to come to South Africa and fabricate cases and expect to be paid with dollars and whatever. Are we going to have, do we have that capacity to pay in dollars while in South Africa, the poor countries, those are the people who started the fund. But at the end, they don't benefit, they don't benefit from the fund. This money must be accumulated, given to some people with powers, and no, I think they are not correct. Thank you, Chair.
If you can respond to me, the issues.
Certainly, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you very much for your comments, Honourable Member Sibande, Honourable Sibande. I hear you, and I respectfully disagree with some of your submissions to the extent. So, if I may, just take you a little bit, one step back. The submissions that you held in your hand were additional submissions, and I said at the outset and explained that the reason why we attached that, even though it was submissions to the South African Human Rights Commission, as well as responses from the Minister of Home Affairs, it was important to submit this to create a contextual picture of some of the challenges that asylum seekers are facing in South Africa in obtaining their documentation. It is not the pivotal submissions that we have submitted, which were the other bundle that you would have been presented, which speak to the three sections that we have made comments on. So I do not want us to get sidetracked by the fact that, yes, we have indicated there are some challenges within the Department of Home Affairs, but it was important to bring them and this information to light on the basis that it had to create that contextual background. On the issue of some foreign nationals being criminals, I do not deny that, but I also submit that South Africans are also found to be criminals, so you cannot focus purely on the distinction of nationality and equating that to criminality, Honourable Member. That in itself would be very dangerous, because then we are isolating one unique characteristic of an individual and creating them in this group. And I think it's attitudes like that sometimes that can feel or start a conversation of xenophobic tendencies. And I'm not saying anything that's directed at you, I'm just saying in general that it is a very thin line to walk and a very dangerous one sometimes. With regards to your final point about South Africa being having the right to create its own laws, absolutely, and I agree with you, but I am not holding a standard by something I've created and thought up on my own, Honourable Sibande. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights that we have as a country created is the keystone of what we should be prescribing to. And as I've mentioned before, and I will do so again, legislation and policies have to promote the rights entrenched in the Constitution. So it says here, and I reiterate this again, we the people of South Africa recognize the injustices of our past, honor those who have suffered for justice and freedom in our land, respect those who have worked to build and develop our country, and believe that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in diversity. We cannot be crying out this is our ethos and foundation and cornerstone if we're suddenly saying let's exclude undocumented foreign nationals, which may be a very small pool in this RAB scheme. I submit once again, I do not believe that by including them and as beneficiaries who, you know, in the event that there are victims in a road accident, it will really create pandemonium in our country. I submit that it's actually a gesture of goodwill as part of a country that upholds its constitutional democracies. Thank you.
The last one, I'm going to give you a minute.
10%. Only two things. Number one, I appeal again. You see, some of the things which are here is contained in this document, like the people you refer to, it must not compromise Transport Department. Don't take it light. It must not compromise the Transport Department. And then also come to the last one. You see, Chairperson, I've asked a question about the issue, like issue of foreigners. We don't have any qualm about the issue of foreigners, but we say charity begins at home. We're supposed to have our laws, and then after, so that because with our laws we are able to have some recommendation, whatever. But South Africa must be taken by as banana republic that people they can just fabricate. I'll put an example. There was in one of the presenters, there's one person who made an I think it's Black Lawyers Association, who made an example whereby some of the people are cooking, put his hand in the machine and then come to claim. That's what we are saying. We need laws who can protect us on that one. And then you never also responded last one about the issue of the you see, in terms of payments and tariffs, because once you open like this, that means other people, they must create an accident, they go back and claim in dollars. Like the issue of, which I mentioned about SOSH. I don't want to go deep into that one. We claim 4.5 billion rands in South Africa. That's what the people are anticipating to get from us. Ah, no, no, Maggie.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mpaza.
Well, Chair, I'm going to be very short, Chair. One thing that I'm just hearing in all this presentation is how unconstitutional is the bill. I'm longing for the day, Chair, where we'll have an interaction, maybe in the days that we have determined, where we'll hear also our legal officials and the department responding, because surely we must have been misled in a big way all along, because I've heard that the bill is very unconstitutional. Mm. Yes. Chair, I just want to ask another question, which is my last question. There are protocols, and international agreements or treaties among or between countries, which are also constitutional. Now, what I want to find out, how do you deal with a situation where now you are having these constitutional treaties and agreements, and then you have this bill, which now you are saying is unconstitutional in some of the elements. How do you deal with a situation where there are contradictions within something that is constitutional? There is a constitution in terms of the treaties, and they are also included in the constitution. They are acknowledged by the United Nations or AU. And then you go against that while you are saying you are trying to make a particular law or bill to be constitutional. So how do you deal with those contradictions? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your question. Honourable Member, I am not 100% sure if I got your question correctly, but let me try answer, and if you're not happy, then we can take a step back and readdress that. My understanding is your question is how would South Africa reconcile with its international obligations in terms of conventions, protocols, etc., and in realizing legislation that we're in the process of drafting. Is that the question? Okay. Thank you. Honourable Member, the first point is that one would need to look at whether or not South Africa, in terms of international obligations, Section 39 says that foreign law may be persuasive, but international law is something one must adhere to. But the catch is that has South Africa ratified the conventions or the protocols? So once South Africa's the South African government has ratified it, then they are obligated to abide by that. But I always take it back, because one would have not ratified those conventions and protocols if it was not in line with our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So that is the cornerstone of our democracy, and that's what we need to keep going back to. And until that, or unless that Constitution changes, then we can reevaluate what our objectives are as a nation, as a country. But the simple answer would then be, one would need to, when drafting the legislation, consider, is it in line with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and or is its limitation justifiable? What are its objectives? And secondly, one would need to look at what our obligations are internationally, and one would need to consider all of that when drafting legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You indicated Section 27, that is according to you unconstitutional. If a need arises, Section 27, Subsection 4, if a need arises, it should be removed. Are there any other clauses that you believe should be looked into?
Honourable Chairperson, just to reiterate, we request that the Parliamentary Committee takes it back to the drafters to relook at Section 27(4) to include undocumented persons to be able to benefit from claims if they are victims of a road accident. One would also suggest that Section 28, which deals with the exclusion of common law rights to the innocent road accident victim, also be reconsidered. It might just be a rewording of that section that needs to be looked at, but I feel like other people that have presented before have dealt with that extensively, and it's certainly not our main focus in the submission. And then thirdly, just to raise that this Chapter 6 in terms of the funeral benefits, whether or not prescribed amount is sufficient, if that can possibly be remedied by a sort of tariff which considers people, an individual's or claimant's personal circumstances. And in our example specifically, a family of a foreigner may need more than 5,000, for example, or even 10,000 to repatriate the cost of that body for the funeral. And that's our submission. So just request that those sections be looked at. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. You have been presenting on two organizations and you were right on time. You didn't even spend an hour on your presentation. I'd like to really applaud you for that, because you were on point. You released, honorable members, we will be taking the last presentation for today, which is the presentation that will be made by the South African Litigation Center. If they are here. Oh. Okay. Just 1 minute. There's another honorable member who would like to ask a question. Honorable Shalembe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm trying to find out the consequences of that presentation, because it has implicated some people who are not here. For instance, His Majesty the King, that matter was discussed, you know, deeply, and His Majesty the King also went out to the public gatherings where he cleared, his name. Now, Honourable Sibanda has raised an issue with that document, that if it goes out, it will, send the wrong message. We don't want to see this thing being discussed in a wrong manner. Well, the presentation is good. As I'm saying, some presentation may be good, but at the wrong place. Because now if you talk about the issue of the police, there is no one here who is representing the police. If you talk about the Home Affairs, there is no one here who is representing the Home Affairs. Talk about Mr. King and other, people being mentioned here. But I would suggest that if it was possible, that, I mean, the committee look at that and see how can we distance ourselves from that document. Because once we take the ownership of that document, if we don't say anything, and then it would be like we were entertaining, I mean, at the issue of people who are not here being discussed. What happened now if Martin Luther King and others say they would like to have a say on the same matter that is attaching them? Not that I'm trying to make your presence or that plastic cow, but I'm telling about something that can happen. The consequences of that may lead to what is not what this committee is intending to. This committee is talking about the issue of benefiting those who've been involved in accident. But now it is going out of that boundary. Chair, this is my submission. I don't know how can we deal with it, but what Sivane was saying is true, and it may happen if it's not controlled yet.
Thank you very much, Honorable. I thought that Honorable Sibande has summed up that we're dealing with the road accident benefit scheme and not dealing with anything outside of the road accident benefit scheme, such that the inputs that should come should be the inputs that focuses on the road accident benefit scheme. And therefore, issues which were raised to Home Affairs, they've got absolutely nothing to do with us. Advocate?
Okay, just to respond quickly on this issue. So this document that attached was our contextual approach, and I agree, this is why I didn't go through some of the other stuff in that additional document. So just to reiterate, our submissions and focus from that document purely deal with statistics that are available to us, okay? So that is the failure of refugee access to refugee reception offices. This is well documented in the courts, and anyone can pull up this court cases, as in plural, on the internet. So this is not disputed. The fact that there are 3 refugee offices that are closed, 2 of them currently that have gone through constitutional challenges, and there were directives to be reopened. This is not disputed. This is a current factual analysis, and that is one explanation as to why asylum seekers are failing to get access to documentation. The second part is the parliamentary answers that were put before the Minister of Home Affairs. This was something that they presented on themselves. And that is available on the PMG website. So I'm limiting my submissions to what has been presented factually, and that's available and accessible in the news, and it's not altered information, court documents and stats that have been brought before the PMG. So I would like to limit and give the contextual challenges limited to that. So I acknowledge your reservations and as well as Honourable Member Sibanda, and I will not, let me say, I'm placing myself on record, we are not submitting the other aspects that are mentioning other individuals, for example, the King. I understand that, yes, that matter has been dealt to the South African Commission, South African Human Rights Commission, but I'm referring specifically to the challenges within the asylum system that are statistics. And I hope that might be able to remedy that a little bit.
The honourable members of this portfolio committee are distancing themselves from this document, which is talking about issues that do not affect what we are doing here, which is to have public hearings on the road accident benefit scheme. That is what, in essence, honourable members are saying, that they would want to distance themselves from every other thing other than focusing on the road accident benefit scheme.
I understand, the honourable chairperson. But just to clarify, our submissions in relation to the impact of the RAB scheme deals with undocumented migrants and asylum seekers, and one of the challenges that asylum seekers face, and one of the reasons why they find themselves in undocumented situations, deals with the challenges within the asylum system. That's it.
Thank you very much. You are excused. The next presentation will be coming from the Southern African Litigation Center. Are they here? Okay. Honorable members, there is some bit of light there. Having watching lunch, honorable members, the Southern African Litigation Center is now here, and they will request them to make a presentation. Like all the others, we're going to give you 30 minutes for your presentation. If you can, you can even do it less, and then the honorable members will interact with your presentation. You are heartily welcome, ma'am. You can ride on.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good day. My name is Kajal Ramjathan Teel. I'm with the Southern Africa Litigation Centre, which is a regional non-governmental organisation based in Johannesburg, operating in 11 Southern African countries. And it is our regional migration work which has prompted us to make this submission this morning. I understand that you have had one submission from Scalabrini, and of course you've heard from Lawyers for Human Rights and the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants. And our submission is also focusing, the majority part of the submission is focusing on the rights of asylum seekers and refugees, as well as on the rights of undocumented migrants. And while our submission is quite broad and focuses on several areas, I will only in oral today deal with that issue, understanding that time is short. First of all, to say that there are significant numbers of asylum seekers, refugees and migrants in the country, both documented and undocumented, and that the immigration laws provide very few mechanisms for low-skilled migrants to be able to regularize their immigration status. So we are concerned that there are provisions in this bill which prejudice in particular undocumented migrants and make very little provision for their care and treatment should they become involved in a motor vehicle accident. I've heard from the discussions this morning that the objectives of the bill are very clear, and deaths on South African roads are a very serious concern. In 2017, there were more than 14,000 persons who lost their lives on South African roads, and even more would have been injured. The RAB bill seeks to introduce a no-fault system, and we regard this as a progressive move. I'll move along and go straight to the issue of concern. We do place on record our concerns with Section 27.4. There are a great number of asylum seekers who have failed to have their permits renewed on time due to no fault on their own part, but rather on account of the ineffective and corrupt asylum system which they are obliged to navigate. This would apply equally to migrants, including migrant children, and this would also apply to South African citizens who have never been able to obtain documents, so who are citizens but are undocumented, and potentially even stateless South Africans who are unable to prove their citizenship. According to the 2011 SA census data, 2.2 million foreign nationals live in South Africa. which has a population of 55 million. Stats SA 2015 data estimates that there are between 500,000 and 1 million undocumented migrants living in the country. This equates to less than 2% of the total South African population. Of this number, it is difficult to say how many undocumented migrants will be involved in future car accidents, but the numbers would be so small that it would not make a significant impact to be inclusive and to include these persons when considering provision of health care and possible damages. And we've heard from the Law Society presentation earlier in the day that persons earning over a certain minimum threshold are excluded from the protections of the bill. So the bill is very specific as to who it is providing protection for. It is for people who are unable to cater for themselves in the event of being involved in a car accident. So it is pro poor. And with our submission, our intention is for the bill to also cater to migrants who are also poor and who would not be able to cater for themselves in the event of injury or death. The fuel levy is imposed on all fuel sold in the country. The contribution is therefore made by owners and drivers of motor vehicles, as well as persons taking public transport in buses, taxis, private motor vehicles. This would include citizens, non-citizens, documented and undocumented persons. Equitable treatment and fairness would require that the benefits available from the scheme should also benefit all persons within the country. It is not the objective of the RABS bill to be involved in immigration enforcement. It is not the objective of the bill to deter persons from residing in the country without a regular immigration status. However, this appears to be what the scheme is purporting to do by preventing undocumented persons from benefiting on an equal basis with the protections provided for citizens, permanent residents, documented foreign nationals. This will result in serious difficulties for people and breadwinners who are injured or killed in motor vehicle accidents. The objective of the scheme is to be reasonable, equitable, affordable, sustainable in the long term than the current scheme. And the scheme would not be equitable and would not afford equal treatment to persons if they were prevented from protection on the basis of their immigration status. Ms. Leung has already spoken about the challenges within the Department of Home Affairs and the difficulties that asylum seekers have to access asylum and to renew their permits. So while our submission deals with it, I won't deal with it in any detail. What I do want to say, however, is that there is on average a 96% rejection rate of asylum claims at the first instance. And almost all of these rejected asylum seekers then can appeal this rejection, which takes many years to finalize. And there was a question raised earlier about what the limits should be on asylum seekers who may or may not be recognized as refugees. And what I want to suggest is that asylum seekers could benefit from protection of the RAB scheme for the duration that they are in the asylum seeking process. If they are subsequently recognized as refugees, they could continue on the process. If they are subsequently rejected, the benefits for those individuals could end because they would have to leave the country in any case. South Africa's national legislation incorporates the basic principles of refugee protection, including freedom of movement, the right to work, access to basic social services. However, some public institutions do not recognize refugee permits and prevent refugees from fully benefiting from these rights. The current socioeconomic environment, which includes high unemployment, poor service delivery, and economic inequality, has strained relations between refugees, asylum seekers, and host populations. South Africa presently hosts just over 91,000 refugees compared to just under 220,000 asylum seekers. the majority from Zimbabwe, and certainly many more undocumented migrants. By comparison, Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe and Mozambique host far fewer refugees. However, Ethiopia, Kenya, Chad, Uganda are carrying the burden of hosting the largest numbers of refugees in Africa and have been doing so for a number of years. South Africa's refugee burden compared to what is being hosted in those countries is very, very much smaller. The numbers are in our submission. We've heard already about the huge appeal backlog in the asylum system, which continues to be a concern. We've put numbers into the submission as well, and currently there's just over 200,000 asylum claims waiting to be adjudicated. And even though these are genuine asylum seekers waiting for adjudication of their claims, it's uncertain whether they are in possession of asylum seeker permits because of the difficulties with the Home Affairs system. And I'm going to stop there because I think we've dealt with many of the other issues.
Yeah, thank you very much, short and concise. Honourable members, are there takers on this matter? Honourable Ramatakana, you're the only one.
No, Chair, thank you very much for the presentation, ma'am. And I think you are beginning to make some suggestion. Would you say that you are responding to the previous submission as well? So you're saying we should think about a transitional clause? A transitional clause in respect of the undocumented asylum seekers, but you have used a different term. You used migrants. So I'm trying to find out what you actually asked us to do. The other presentation was talking about undocumented. Now, maybe you can explain, because if you're talking about people who have been in South Africa, who have a documentation, who are recognized, let's say they work in Balco. They come from one of our countries, SADC, and they have a permit. They have a degree of a permit. It means they are recognized. Now, or you're talking purely by simply people, I just want to understand your term and what's the distinction between the two terms. And you made another comment about fuel levy. And I don't know whether it's a well-considered response or if you're reacting to the question of the previous presenter who I asked that question. Assuming that you have 10 million or 11 million car owners in the country, and they buy fuel, and you have other 5 million who are not necessarily registered South Africans. So your suggestion is that everyone who bought petrol once in their period of staying, they should be considered. How would we write this in the bill? What is going to be a tracking mechanism? Are you suggesting that anybody who pays a petrol slip, who has a petrol slip, somehow will find a link to be linked as a record of someone who has once purchased a diesel, and by that extension becomes then the benefactor of the scheme? I'm just trying to understand the logic, how this is going to happen in practice. Because here now you're saying, forget about the citizenship, forget about this, just use a fuel levy as a measure of measuring the rights and person to benefit. And I mean, fuel levy or whatever you pay, sometimes you pay in cash. How are you going to be able to track that? Is it going to be a good law? That's going to be based on that. Practically, how are we going to be able to do this in the end? I don't think the issue is, for us, is the issue is the magnitude of the numbers. But the issue here is the whole principle of coming to an act. Is this law applicable to South Africans or non-South Africans? I think that's the critical question for us. You're saying it should be beyond. I asked the previous presenter, what is the authority of this? Is a gut feeling that it is a good thing to do? Which country does this? I mean, mentioned two in the SADC, or five in the SADC, that have this same, and that we can, some South African can get payment as a result of the accident that happens in one of those countries, as an evidence. Because if it's not an evidence base, it doesn't exist. It's a gut feel or feel good. And you can't make the law on the basis of feel good. That has a major implication in terms of the finance of the country. It's actually beyond the sexual commissions. It's far, far over it. If you're talking about linking it with the social security, talking about sustainability, equitability, taking into account the resource base. You're asking us to have to cast the net wide. If you can just maybe help us convince us that actually we are not asking that. Because so far it suggests that this is exactly what we are asking, which is not based on clear evidence. For me, I haven't, everybody that has come here who has made this seminar presentation has fallen short of answering the question based on we haven't done the study, we don't know. So how do you make the argument if you don't have something that supports that particular argument? So should we make the law on the basis of everybody that comes here that appeal to us on the basis of emotions, or should we really be based on evidence that exists? I think maybe the latter is correct. Maybe your comment on that. Thank you, Chair.
To you, ma'am.
To respond to your question, your last issue first, earlier you raised the question about international obligations. And to respond on that, South Africa has ratified the United Nations 1951 Convention on Refugees and has also ratified the 1969 OAU Convention on Refugees. So at the minimum, South Africa has obligations to protect refugees. It's an international protection mandate which should continue into various spheres of protection within a specific country, and it should also be included within the RAPS bill. So in respect of asylum seekers and refugees, I submit that they should get protection from the RAPS bill. And with asylum seekers and refugees, they should have documentation and should be in a regular situation, but on account of difficulties within home affairs, are not always in possession of documentation. South Africa has not ratified the Convention on the Protection of Migrant Workers and Their Families. It's an international convention which has been in place for many years. South Africa has not sought to ratify it. Many sending countries have ratified. South Africa, we don't know whether South Africa is ever going to ratify this convention. So certainly, in terms of international obligations, that is an issue. And you've asked me certain questions about, well, I've responded on refugee protection for refugees and asylum seekers in particular. It is your duty as Parliament to decide what is best for the country, and my duty as an advocate for migrants and refugees to advocate on their behalf. So while I would advocate for an inclusive approach for the RABS bill to cover migrants both documented and undocumented equally. It is up to Parliament, the decision lies with Parliament, and I'm not going to speak on it any further. I leave it with you.
No, Chair, I respect that. I do respect that. It is our responsibility to make law, but good laws. I underline the good laws. That's the reason why we have asked for public comment. That's why we are respectfully listening to your presentation. Just a follow-up question is this. The non-ratified treaty, which accidentally one of it is the one that we're talking about, if you like that. Are you suggesting that by inclusion of this provision, we would automatically, by way, ratifying the unratified treaty? It sounds like that. And if it's so, because remember the whole, you say it's whole process of the country. And many countries have not ratified many treaties. It's because of the sovereignty they consider it before they do. Yes, there is. The country has a responsibility to protect in terms of those conventions. But are you suggesting that there's no limitation that falls away? The limitation clause falls away because anybody who are affected by crime can't get assisted by the police. Non-South Africans, emergency services, they do get assistance. And that's in compliance. But there is some degree of limitation when it comes to perpetual or commitment to infinity, if you like. Are you suggesting that we should go down that road? Because you have to, as an advocate, you also have to tell us the implications, possible implications for that, in line with what we already have and heard from what has been suggested by the commissions, various commissions. Because it seems to me that your suggestion with respect goes beyond what is already before us. And as a presenter, I'm saying, it seems like you haven't considered other aspect of it. But then you say, this is not my responsibility, it's your responsibility to consider some of those. Fine, I think we take it at that. But can I ask you, in terms of the last question, you do agree with the fact that there are problems with the current act, and therefore that the current act requires some attention and the review. That's all, Chair. Thanks.
Go ahead, Nick.
In terms of ratification of the Convention on the Protection of Migrant Workers and Their Families, inclusion of undocumented migrants in this act does not automatically mean that the convention becomes ratified. That is a separate process which South Africa will need to engage with as a separate event. So by no means is that an automatic process. You asked about the limitations clause. Certainly there is space for the use of the limitations clause, but not including certain groups as part of the RABS bill does mean that this issue would be open to a legal challenge at any stage, and which would then be outside of the realm of Parliament. It would be with the courts to decide, if such a challenge is launched, whether or not an individual who is not covered by the RAB scheme is entitled to such protection. So it's I just want to raise that to say that, you know, there are potential challenges for individuals who and classes of people who won't be covered at some future time to challenge it. Honorable Sibande.
Chairperson, I'll start by saying thank you very much for this presentation, but nevertheless, I wanted some few clarifications.
You see, I'll go to the question which was raised earlier on by my colleague, Honorable Ramatlakane, about the issue of fuel levy. Some people, maybe if they do their research, they don't go practical to the area. They take theory, not practical. How do you classify? Let's say you're from, some people are not aware about this. Those who are saying everything, I can recall the times we were still debating about the issue of toll gates and e-tolls and the like, whereby there was a strong debate about the issue of fuel levy. I'm from Mpumalanga. It's very painful, shame and disgrace for your information. If you're from Commerce, first toll gate is in Kapmeiden. From Kapmeiden, you'll pay about 50-something rents in a toll gate, single trip. And then you go to Macharadorp. So pay about 60-something rents. You go to Milbeck, pay about 70-something to 80-something rents. If you're going to Pretoria, go to Bronspruit. But some people, they expect that again, they still emphasize that, no, when we get money, we must get it from a fuel levy. Is that practical? Why the claim is that you are representing the poor people? Why the target is the poor people? Because to me, if you link that one, the fuel levy, and the practical, what is happening, it means that in Mpumalanga they are being double charged. They are being double charged for the fuel, also being charged for the issue of the toll gates. I don't think that is fair. What is your response in that regard? Because it's you who touched the issue of the fuel levy. And then the issue of, you see also, Chairperson, the issue of refugees and asylum seekers. I think there is a quite difference. There are categories. It doesn't mean that it should, like the word which is used by other people, that illegally immigrants. To me, it is a shame and disgrace that to find that our own people are justifying things which are illegal. Underline, illegally. Immigration, just through the legal documents, you know, we can debate some of the things about the issue of immigration and some people are seeking work and the like. But those people are documented. So, in also, I need your clarity on that one. And then, you put an example of that, this thing of asylum seekers, was there since 1952. South Africa didn't do the ratification. But here comes the joke. Here we are dealing the matter which started in 1942. The intention of the bill is to do the ratification, but there is a confrontation with some people that wanted to defend it, that it mustn't take place at all. It mustn't take place at all because it's going to affect our clients. So what is your take in that one? Because the main sole purpose, actually, Jefferson, I didn't want it to come and just triggered by my colleague, because this is the same presentation like the previous one. We're not talking about immigration and refugees. We're talking about transport and RAF's bill. Thank you, Chairperson.
I'm afraid I'm not certain what your first question was in respect to fuel levies and toll gates. There are toll fees all over the country. Not only in Mpumalanga, so I'm not clear on that question. And on the issue of asylum seekers and refugees, the point that both my submission and the previous submission was trying to make is that yes, they are undocumented. They are asylum seekers and refugees are documented people. They're supposed to be documented people. But the fact remains is that Home Affairs is not always able to provide them with documents. That is the issue. So for purposes of the RABS bill, they might not always be able to provide a document to show that they are an asylum seeker or refugee. That was the point of the submission.
Chairperson, let me clarify something quick now. You see, we can have toll gates everywhere in the country, but payments are not the same. Case closed. Because if you compare the prices which you talk about And if you compare the people whom you, we claim that we are representing, there's no fair justice. In Mpumalanga, roughly, if you're from Mkomazi, you must have 1,000 rands, approximately 800 and something for toll gates only. While you're talking about some of the areas, if you're from Durban to Joburg, you're talking about 50 cents, 2 rand 50. You can't compare petrol and water. It's not the same. Although both are liquid. And then also, I'm not yet satisfied because you didn't respond to the you're taking about the issue of ratification, because the intention of bringing this draft bill is to try to correct some of the measures, because from and the records whereby there were a lot of atrocities within the road accident fund. And we are trying to correct the laws which were there before yourself and myself, we were born in 1942. And luckily, you are putting an example that that's why you are talking about this one, the refugees, and not because South Africa didn't ratify. But when South Africa started to ratify some of these things, also, other people are blocking. I will be very much happy if you can direct us as well, which, from my own view, sectors which are not constitutional. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes, ma'am. The matter of which sections are constitutional or not constitutional really is a matter for engagement, and certainly, you know, if an issue is raised to be unconstitutional, it's for the Constitutional Court to decide whether or not something is constitutional or unconstitutional. We haven't used those particular terms in the submission. We have used terms on regarding fairness and equity, which is what is used. Are the terms used as the objectives of the bill? So we have not specifically alluded to constitutionality of specific sections, although that may still be tested if the bill is passed in its current form. Our submission is quite detailed on, in particular, section 27.4, which is the section that we're concerned with. So I would refer you to our submission.
Honorable Shalembe.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, one finds it extremely difficult, you know, for this committee or the Department of Transport. Because if you listen to all these concerns, it's like before, Act is approved, all these concerns from different departments must be addressed. But I don't know how. Because if you look on page 7 of that document, it says, we are further concerned the Department of Home Affairs does not assist persons who should be legally in the country with documents to prove their immigration status. Now, but we don't get the reasons, but it says, do not assist. Now, I don't know whether you have been able to approach the department per se, or the head of department or the director to say, we have a problem where your department is not assisting. If you do not get, the audience that makes you happy, then you can proceed maybe to go to the minister to say, Minister of Home Affairs, we have this problem. But now, if it's like this, do not assist. We do not know why. Because if others can be assisted and others cannot be assisted, we don't know why. But if maybe reason can be given that on that particular day, a person was sent to the department and the department refused to assist that person, then we are able maybe to say, Chair, can you communicate with a relevant chairperson of portfolio committees in those departments? It goes on to say these are few illustrations of challenges. These are few. So it means there are numbers which homosexuals have failed to satisfactorily resolve. I think in that case, Chair Person, we cannot just turn a blind eye as if we don't see that there is a poor communication between them and the Department of Home Affairs. Once that, I mean, it is done properly, maybe this problem can be solved. Otherwise, if you look all the number of challenges, it means now we won't be able to proceed up until these challenges are addressed, whereas we do not have that power to address those issues. So that is my appeal, that if maybe that can be channeled to the right department, so they can do theirs while we are doing ours. I thank you.
There you are, ma'am. Yes, thank you, thank you. Honourable Member, I do take exception to that statement. It is a very serious matter with the Department of Home Affairs and its management of the asylum seeker management system. There are numerous research reports as well as court cases documenting these issues, so it's not something that I'm just raising which I've had one instance of a problem with. There appears to be a very serious problem within the Department of Home Affairs in the way that it manages asylum seekers and refugees and issues permits and renews permits for those individuals. And this is what we were trying to raise with this transport committee. It would not make sense for us to bog you down with reams and reams of paper, which is why we've alluded to the issues with not a lot of detail. If you require that detail, it can be provided to you. But the fact of the matter remains that it's not poor communication with the Department of Home Affairs which has resulted in these problems. It is maladministration and poor administration by the Department of Home Affairs which has created these problems.
I'm just thinking out loud that in the eventuality you will come in an asylum seeker, undocumented, goes to the road accident, go and claim, gets given whatever will be given. He doesn't have any documents and comes back again to come and claim. This is the person who doesn't have documents. How will we be able to handle that? How will we be able to deal with that, so that the system doesn't get defrauded by undocumented migrants into the Republic? Before you respond, let me take Honorable Shelembe again.
Yes, Chairperson. Note that I don't think the presenter must, you know, get emotional with these issues. It's not her fault. But what we are saying now, if I go to Home Affairs and I want an ID, I'm South African, and then I don't have documents, now do I need to blame the department if it does not assist me because I must get the documents? So the issue here is to have more people without documents, benefiting from the scheme. But if that can be done to reduce the number of people without documents to get benefit from the scheme, I think that is the issue. So that is my request. It's not that we are trying to, to make you, but we understand your background. But I'm not happy when it comes to how many times have you tried to get the head of Department of Home Affairs or the Director General?
There are so many court cases in which Home Affairs has failed to provide documents, in which a court has ordered them to provide documents, and they've still failed to provide documents, and this is an ongoing problem. It seems that the norm is for Home Affairs to ignore court orders. That is the way that the system has been operating, and in particular the system with regards to asylum seeker management. It's not a matter of how many times one has communicated with the DG or the head of department or the minister. There's a very serious problem within the Department of Home Affairs. And it's not a matter of failing to communicate enough with the department. The issue of documents is precisely the issue that we're trying to raise with this committee. We're saying that asylum seekers and refugees filing asylum claims and in need of international protection are not always getting the documents they require. So they're going to have extreme difficulties in lodging any claims with the RAB scheme. They're going to have extreme difficulties in showing, improving their status in the country because of this difficulty with Home Affairs. There's very little that we can do about this, but we are alerting you to the fact of this, because this is an ongoing problem and a problem which these individuals are going to face and which is going to prejudice them if they are involved in motor vehicle collisions.
Yes, Mr. Chairperson, I don't want to delay just a comment. You see, but I can't understand this one. We have different departments with different platforms. We can't be bogged down by the issues of the Home Affairs because Home Affairs didn't do what this intruded, then we can't pass the law. That's my problem. Because at the end, it's like omunye phezu komunye, omunye ukhomba omunye. It doesn't work like that. I'm sorry, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm sorry. You see what? Chairperson, I thought some of the issues which are supposed to go to Home Affairs, they were due to be taken to Home Affairs, to say, Home Affairs, here are the challenges, this. Because like ourselves who are sailing in transport, I'll put an example. I can't respond in terms of, like myself, I once worked before international affairs become foreign affairs. That's why sometimes when we touch issues, I'll tell you exactly because I was serving there. Even with Home Affairs, I can. But I can't respond on the behalf of Home Affairs. What I'm appealing is that it's better present us, try to help us. Don't lose focus. Help us with the things which are dedicated to us as part of our task. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I think it was more of a statement than a question, but you can talk to it if you feel like. Thank you very much. Honorable Ramataka.
Just add before the advocate respond. Just a small addition, advocate. Is it your view that because of the problem that, numerous problems that you have with Home Affairs, with respect to the backlog and, that now we should slap them with an amendment with this act that makes provision of everybody else that irrespective of whether they have status or not. In other words, you are so angry to an extent that now that we have this act on the table, we should just bring this semi, because it's almost semi giving us particular status through this act. Is that your view?
Thank you. That is not my view. I'm not suggesting that you use this act, and it's not possible to use this act to deal with Home Affairs' mismanagement. Home Affairs, of course, will need to sort out their own problems, but I think it's prudent for this committee to be aware of the difficulties within the Home Affairs system and to take them into account in drafting this bill, particularly with regards to access to benefits for asylum seekers and refugees who might be in the system, might be able to produce a document to show that they've applied, but that document might be expired for whatever reason. For example, because they can't get access to Home Affairs to renew a document, which is very often the case. So it's just, we wanted to alert you to the fact that there are difficulties with asylum seeker and refugee documents and that these persons shouldn't be prejudiced by the RAB scheme if they're having difficulty accessing documents to prove their status.
Yeah.
I think, honourable members, this is just one of the things that it's applied from people who have migrated and refugees in the Republic of South Africa, which actually all the presenters from the Lawyers for Human Rights and the other ones that came indicated to say, as you are dealing with this, take cognizance of the fact that there are challenges which are beyond the refugees or the immigrants into the Republic. And therefore, I think as we will be discussing forward, we should be able to take cognizance of issues that have been raised on behalf of the non-South Africans. If I can be able to say, let's put it in a parking bay. There will be time when we will be discussing this bill in full, and when we come to clause 27 subsection 4, we should be able to remind ourselves that there were several organizations which made a plea on behalf of the non-South Africans, and then we should be able to say how do we take that forward. Let me thank you, ma'am.
But we should not create an impression that we are satisfied with what has been presented.
No, we are not.
Because what has been presented to us is impossibility. For anybody to get the status, there is a whole lot of things that must be satisfied. For a person that must do that, including the motivation, the reasons, the country you're coming from, all kinds of things. So I just wanted to record that yes, there has been plea, but they have not answered the question how this to be done. That's all I wanted just to say.
Definitely, Honorable Ramatlakana, that is why I'm saying we put everything that they have spoken to in a parking bay so that come our discussions, we should be able to make further reflections on this matter. Because I'm just thinking out loud that if you come from Mozambique and be an asylum seeker, what? How do we take that? And we can be able to talk on so many other things, but let's put it in a parking bay, honorable members. Let me thank you, ma'am, and your organization, that is the Southern African Litigation Center. We definitely are very happy that you heeded the call to come and put your case. One of the things that we would like to impress upon everybody who has presented is that your presentation did not fall onto deaf ears. Honorable members, we will be adjourning today, but before we adjourn, earlier on, when there was an indication of the pictures which were shown, I wrongly attached the picture of a lady to the lawyers, South African Law Society, Law Society of South Africa. But it was not their presentation. It was the DSC attorneys that made that kind of a presentation. And I wanted to correct that for the record, and also to apologize for the Law Society of South Africa that I attached wrongfully so what did not belong to them. My apology to the Law Society of South Africa. The picture belonged to the CDC, DSC attorneys. On that note, honorable members, the meeting is adjourned. We will be starting again next week on Tuesday to continue with our presentation. I'm sure honourable members have got the agenda for what we are going to be doing next week in terms of the presentation from different organisations. Thank you very much once more, everybody who has participated for today. The meeting is adjourned. Sorry, honourable members, the meeting will not be there on Tuesday. It will be only on Wednesday. We will be doing the 30th is a Wednesday, and then Thursday. We will do Wednesday and Thursday next week.
May I please have a copy?
I only have one. Could you give me an email address or something?
Okay.
Could you try it down for me? This has writing all over it. Shamila Mpinga at your medical. I'll send it on to her.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. It's very difficult because I mean, like you said, it's very difficult to track these kind of things.